go? Okay, I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. Thank you, members. For people who are here from the public, there are all kinds of members in all kinds of committees, and we're not going to waste time because we have, I don't even know, 20 bills today. So we, the first author in the room was Representative Nornes, so he's going to go for first, and Representative Nornes will take your House File 830.
We don't have the information yet, though.
Oh, we're waiting for pages to bring the information, but if you and your testifiers want to tell us about the bill, we will move it and lay it over for possible inclusion after we have a quorum. Representative Nornes, welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to go first here today. House File 830, and reminds me, isn't there a radio station with those 830?
A little.
Okay. Anyway, no connection to this, but exactly, this legislation deals with the JobZ program, and as you know, that has a sunset down the, about 2015, and it's my intention by this legislation to continue JobZ with its full impact up until that sunset date. In other words, if someone is ready to begin a project, that they would get the full 10-year benefit from the start date. And instead of, under the current system, we have a deteriorating benefit or a declining benefit. So that's what this is intended to do, to give anyone that's beginning a project to get to know that they'd have 10 years of benefit. That's kind of the bottom line. I have with me today some testifiers. I'd like to start with Chuck Johnson, who's from Purim. That's Dean Simpson's district. And they've had a lot of success with JobZ in that community.
Thank you, Representative Nornes, and welcome, Mr. Johnson. And Representative Nornes, I don't know that your microphone's on, because I'm having a really hard time hearing you. Is it? Okay, well.
I'll lean in.
Yeah, that's better. That's good. Okay, and members, we, Representative Nornes, we're hearing this bill now because he's got testifiers who have to get back to where they live, and we don't have the materials for the bill in front of us. The pages are getting them now because we thought we would hear this one tonight. But you will be receiving the information in just a few minutes here. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and welcome. Thank you for getting us on the agenda as you did. I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the EGA director for the city of Purim, small town in west central Minnesota. Yes. I've done this for roughly 4.5 years. The city of Purim is a very successful small town. It's a town of roughly 2,800 people. And the city can make an unusual statement because there's more jobs in Purim than there are people in Purim. There's probably about 3,200 jobs in Purim versus a population of 2,800. City of Purim has been active in JobZ. We have 8 active JobZs in place today, representing a job commitment total of 86. It's interesting to note that of those 8 projects, and the commitment to at least 86 new jobs, those 8 companies have probably produced about 170 new jobs since entering into those agreements, those JobZ agreements. It's also interesting to note the nature of the companies that we've done business with our JobZ. One of those companies tends to be a more local type company. Two of those companies, tend to do business throughout the state of Minnesota. Two of those companies tend to do business throughout the upper Midwest, probably a 5 or 6 state region throughout the upper Midwest, and 3 of those companies are doing business on a national scale with distribution of products from here to both coasts and the southern part of the United States. So it's been a significant impact both locally, regionally, and in fact on a national basis. As Representative Nornes pointed out, with the declining window of JobZ, it has an impact on the overall net value of JobZ. One of the aspects, as the legislature is aware, that deals with JobZ is the fact that a JobZ project, when a company enters into JobZ, they need to pay prevailing wage on construction of the facility. As prevailing wage is paid, that generally causes an increase in the cost of construction for a facility. That increased cost of construction is partially offset by the benefits of JobZ. I talked recently to a contractor who bid out a large project. It was a $6.3 million project that he bid out. That project had an impact of $750,000 for prevailing wage. Now, and in fact, that project did not proceed as a Job Z project. As the window of Job Z shrinks, the company's ability to recoup that increased cost of construction shrinks accordingly. And it will reach a point of diminishing return where the teeter-totter tips the other direction. In fact, it'll probably cost more to enter into a Job Z and pay prevailing wage than it would not to enter into Job Z. Therefore, it's significant and important that the 10-year window that's being considered be put in place to keep that teeter-totter from tipping the other direction. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate it. And Representative Simpson's here now, so I'm sure he's going to have things to say about your community as well. Your other testifiers, Representative Nornes.
Are you next? Harold Stanislawski. He's from Fergus Falls and has a similar job to Chuck Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Stanislawski. Nice to see you again.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to speak in favor of this bill. I am the Economic Development Director for the City of Fergus Falls, and I would just say this, that this has been one of the most useful and powerful economic development tools that we have in our toolbox in rural Minnesota. We have done deals in the manufacturing area, in the printing business, in high tech, and this program really works. I just want to indicate to the committee where we are getting these deals. Recently, we did a deal with a firm from Iowa that chose to relocate their door manufacturing facility to Fergus Falls, and this is going to provide meaningful jobs growth for the city of Fergus Falls in the future. In addition to that, one of my testifiers here today is going to talk to you about a Fortune 500 company from Dallas, Texas that set up a high-tech computer business in our community, largely related to what was on the table with Job Z. We also are right in the process now of building a $100 million ethanol facility that was also a recipient of this particular program. One of the things that is so important about this program is that the county governments have to pass resolutions of support on every deal. The counties and the cities have to pass resolutions of support on every deal. And we've even done two with townships. And the townships have supported the deals. And if any one of those decides that they don't like the deal on the table, then the Job Z thing doesn't happen. So you have to have unanimous local government support for the project. This has been a great program for us. There's a sense of optimism in rural Minnesota. There's a sense of optimism in Fergus Falls and places like Perm. And I visited with my colleagues in Redwood Falls and other places across the state. And they all tell me the same thing, that this is a tool that works, and we're able to experience growth.
Thank you, Mr. Stanislawski. Representative Nornes,
I'd also like to have you listen. Rick Anderson is a business owner in Fergus Falls and also very involved here as we're creating jobs, and has some comments.
Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, representatives, I had an opportunity to start working with this company out of Dallas, Texas, November of last year. And after the hurricanes in Mississippi and Louisiana, they had a few facilities that were destroyed, and so they were looking for different locations. I felt there was an opportunity, and I started working with them. But what would attract the business to rural Minnesota? Why would a Texas-based Fortune 500 with 800 locations worldwide locate in rural Minnesota? Well, it comes down to cost per employee. We competed with Kuala Lumpur, we competed with India, we competed with North Carolina, South Dakota, North Dakota, Texas, Arizona. And the savings of $1,500 per employee tipped the scale to Minnesota and leveled the playing field with these other states. This is a business decision, and it comes down to cost per employee to the employer. They looked at the education that was available in the area. We opened a 10,000-square-foot facility in Fergus Falls. They started operation in July of last year. We had a grand opening in August. And since that time, we formed a job skills partnership agreement with the Minnesota Community and Technical College in Fergus Falls. This partnership created an $88,000 grant for the college. This fall, they'll become a Microsoft-certified training center. It'll be a Microsoft IT Academy. This will add teachers to their staff to support the curriculum. and it's adding students to that institution, and it provides a career path for our local students starting in the junior high. Reuse of a dilapidated building has spurred several hundred thousand dollars in remodeling and increasing the tax base for Fergus Falls. Our local office supply store had a $60,000 order for workstations and desks. Out of the first 100 employees, they will have about 70% of them from out of town. We estimate that will add 100 kids to our school district. We are experiencing declining enrollment, so this will help change the trend and keep teachers employed in Fergus Falls. Fergus Falls School District is suffering declining enrollment like many school districts across the state, and we're very close to statutory operating debt. We're, in fact, we're on the watch list. So adding 100 students over the next 5-6 years is going to rectify that situation. Could we have done this without Job Z? I would have to say no. No, do the benefits outweigh the cost of implementing the program? Without a doubt. It's a win-win for both our community and our college, but it also needs to be a win for the employer. Not only did it bring new jobs to our rural community, but it brought high-tech jobs that were not available in our area to our young people. My son lives down here at Eden Prairie, and he is a network administrator, and he had to come to Minneapolis to find a job in his field. In putting together the educational aspect of this deal with this company, we spoke with instructors and colleges all across the state. Speaking to instructors in St. Cloud, they indicated to me that their students don't want to have to come to Minneapolis to find the jobs in the technical field. So this is starting to provide those jobs in rural Minnesota. We are now working towards expanding their workforce with other divisions once they have a successful footprint in Fergus Falls. This expansion in Fergus Falls could approach a $50 million investment. And I can guarantee you that isn't going to happen if we don't have Job Z. With the neighboring states offering the same benefits, it's very difficult to tip the scale in our favor. And I'm afraid it will become more challenging with the increase in taxes that are proposed this year. Comp costs, increase in gas taxes, increases in income taxes. It is the jobs that drives the state economy. We need help in rural Minnesota. Let's help our employers to move to Minnesota, and then you'll have increased tax revenue. If we lose this economic tool, we cannot increase our tax base, and everybody loses. Our community, our schools, and our retail community. We need the tools to try and increase our base, and we need a program like Job Z to accomplish this. And that is the extent of my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you for testimony, Mr. Anderson. Before we take questions from committee members, is anyone from the governor's office here, or Representative Nornes, maybe you can tell me, is your bill the governor's proposal this year? I cannot recall exactly what the governor's recommendation was.
Actually, it's not his bill, but I understand it lines up with his bill. So this was kind of our initiative, and then I also found out that the governor has basically the same language somewhere. So we're in full agreement. That's the best I can answer that question.
We do have someone from the governor's office here who might want to join us. And members, we have more Job Z bills. We were going to get to those tonight. So I don't know when members feel they want to have the full Job Z discussion, if it's now or tonight. But I do think it's helpful, since we're trying to have Representative Nornes testifiers get on the road here. And he was first in the room, so that's why we're hearing us now. But the governor it's a long way back in January, and we just want members to recall the governor is proposing something similar. So maybe if you could tell us what that is. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian McDaniel, Department of Employment and Economic Development. Don't have much to add other than what Representative Nornes said. This is not necessarily the governor. This is not a governor's bill, but it is in some substance similar, if not exactly the same, as is our proposal. So I guess I stand here saying the governor does support Representative Nornes' bill.
Thank you. Can I ask you, if I may, does your department produce this Positively Minnesota Job Z newsletter? Okay. Will you be available tonight as we do
yes.
more Job Z bills? Because I know the Senate, I think, is eliminating Job Z's in the tax bill.
Yes,
and I'm sure you know, members here are very divided on whether they're advocates or opponents of Job Z, and that's separate from whether they or not they should be expanded. But I know the Senate has just included an elimination of Job Z in their bill. So I do think we're going to want to have some broader policy debate at some point before we put the omnibus tax bill together. So. With that, if they're Representative Nornes,
I was just going to say there's some misinformation, I think, dealing with the cost of Job Z to the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to ask Harold Stanislawski if he could share some information he has in regards to what the cost actually is.
Certainly, Mr. Stanislawski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Yesterday afternoon, I asked Bob Isaacson, who's the Director of Analysis and Evaluation at DEED, to give us the cost of Job Z to the state of Minnesota. He then contacted the Department of Revenue, and they estimated Job Z benefits totaled about $12.1 million in 2005. The 2004-2005 Job Z businesses reported to DEED, there were 3,669 new jobs for a cost per full-time job of $3,300 per job. If we add the 2,000 retained jobs, the cost per job is $2,100. In addition, the first year of Job Z, oftentimes there's construction that takes place. New buildings get built and there's sales tax that is forfeited by the state. But if we took the sales tax out after the first year, then the cost is $6.7 million currently to the state of Minnesota with this program, which would bring the cost per job down to $1,800 per job, which is, in my opinion, a very good value for what we're getting out of the program. And these numbers, again, can be obtained from Bob Isaacson with DEED.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. as you're well aware of, I've been a supporter of the Job Z since the inception of it. And I really appreciate the fact that we have testifiers here that are out in the field and using the Job Z and seeing the results. And we're seeing the results in many ways. And as our testifiers talked about the things that are happening, not only are we creating jobs, but we're bringing students back into our school systems. We're providing jobs that need educational experience, so we're working with the University of Minnesota, I know in Fergus they are, and developing programs. So this thing just has a broad-based support of a lot of different entities, and I think that this committee and the Senate committee should really strongly look at more than just the few numbers that seem to want to glare out in front of them. This has really revitalized rural Minnesota. If you look at this map that's on the back of this deed thing, just take a look at where you're seeing these circles on here. You're seeing growth in parts of the state that have really been flat. And members, rural Minnesota, we need to have this growth if we're going to continue to see our schools survive. I think that's the most important, one of the most important parts about this. As we continue to see declining enrollment in our rural areas, if we don't provide work for our families, we're going to have a crisis out in rural Minnesota with our educational system. We're going to have to start figuring out a way to deliver education at a different rate. So I'm very pleased that these people are willing to come down here, testify on behalf of this, and hopefully let you people know that this is a successful program, it's working, and we need to continue on this path.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, with the numbers that the last speaker gave, and you know, I'm all for trying to get economic development going statewide and in our rural areas, and have for years felt that a key to that is education, your education institution, so I was glad that you mentioned that as being a key partner. But mm-hmm. The question I want to ask, when we've had discussions about TIFT in the past, you know, we've had the test but for in terms of determining the job gains. And I guess the question then is of the last speaker when you talked about the jobs and the cost per job, is there a but-for test in there that can we be reasonably comfortable then that all the numbers you were using and the number of jobs in particular would not have taken place if it were not for Job Z, or would some of them take place? Kind of talking about what the net might have been without it.
Well, Madam Chairman, Representative Carlson, I think what happens, what I've seen as an economic developer, is that when you put a tool like this in front of the businessman or woman, what they look at is, you know, I may have expanded, but this is going to make me expand faster, and I'll put more employees on the table than I would have otherwise. That's one reason. Second reason is, for us, I'm 25 miles from the South Dakota-North Dakota border, and they always look over there to say, well, how do we compare to the economic environment there? This has simply put us on a level playing field with the Dakotas, and now I can sit at the table and say, you know, we can do we can do what they can do. And what I'm finding here is when we're signing these deals, they make promises to hire so many jobs, or there's a clawback provision that Deed has to remove these benefits. But in almost every case, what we're finding, at least in our community, is that they're exceeding the job numbers that they promised, because things are working out in their favor. So, you know, I'm optimistic based on what we see out in our area.
And, I'm not sure if we can get at the answer I'm questioning you for the information I'm requesting. But that was a test ban, Chair, that we used to use in those discussions with Kip, was, you know, the but-for. And I guess I'm looking for some comfort level, and maybe your one case. I know that there was a lot of discussion and publicity when we were looking at the job Z question relative to one of the job Z zones close to the metropolitan area and the Wisconsin line, and whether that would have happened in Minnesota anyway or not. And I think there was a, I'll just say, cloud or debate put over that. I'm referring to, I think it was Anderson Windows.
Right.
Whether they would have expanded in Minnesota anyway, or if they would have gone to Wisconsin, or if they were just using that as kind of a bargaining chip, if you will.
Representative
Chair and Representative.
That's the problem that we're trying to solve.
Representative Carlson. Well, I can tell you 100% with positive evidence, actually, that the computer company, this Fortune 500 company, would not have come. That would not have been a, I mean, they only came because of, not, there would be no other reason that they would relocate here and instead of India or other places where they could have relocated to. So that's probably the largest example, best example we have of what can happen if we have the right tools.
Thank you. Rep. Semdel.
Thank you, Chairman Chesky. I just want to make an invitation to those businesses that are listening to look at that blue area on that map. Senator Bach, chief authored this bill over in the Senate, and I was a front page author, and it just looks to me like we've got job Z success everywhere except up where we're at. So come one and come all.
Representative Silver.
Madam Chair, to try to answer Representative Carlson's question a little bit, we always have empirical evidence that it's up, we have the successes, and we look at those successes. But I also know of a couple of, three dots that have some history on them. Two of them happened to be in Itasca County. One of them would have expanded but went across the road to expand because of the tax benefit. And so there's no but-for test there, but his competitor wasn't real happy about with him because we gave one business a competitive disadvantage over the competitor that was his neighbor as well. In the job Z zone. So the but-for test was not taken very seriously in it. Another one of the dots, the guy was expanding and someone asked him, are you going to have job Z? He said, well, why wouldn't I? Because it's there anyway, I might as well take advantage of it. It was never a but-for test being given on that. So those jobs, even though they're counted, would have existed anyway. And I'm familiar with one of the other dots in southwestern Minnesota. The plant was being constructed, and we get a newspaper article that they were given job Z after the construction started. And wasn't that real nice? And again, there wasn't any of the but-for test being taken place. So I think we have to be careful of saying that every one is a success, or that it would have happened anyway, or not happened anyway. Now, I understand that there are probably economic development tools that we need to have, but we have to also be very careful as a legislative body that we keep the playing field level for not only the businesses across the border, but within the border. And I've had some empirical evidence that that has not happened. So we have to be careful.
And Representative Nornes, I think maybe your testifiers want to weigh in here, but I think it's helpful for the whole committee and for your testifiers. I would like to just have some context here, and I'm going to ask Mr. Michael, if I may, to just get a little at this question that's being raised now. And if you can step back from your personal experience, all of us, and just think about this for a minute. The question I would pose is, whether it's Jobs Ease or tax increment financing or abatements, or we used to have eminent domain, that tool has been lost. There are many ways the Minnesota legislature subsidizes corporations. This is one of them, Jobs E. And the question always is this but-for concept. How do you prove it? You know, how would you not know that maybe that job maybe wouldn't come to your community, but it would come somewhere else? And the dollar cost of what's the level of price per subsidy? You know, what is the subsidy price per job? Because there's certainly other folks who are arguing for subsidies here this year who are creating, you know, 10,000 jobs, or, you know, we've got the whole gamut here this year. And so I think it's just good for all of us maybe to hear the nonpartisan framing of how we might want to think about these all together, because with the Senate proposing to eliminate Jobs Ease, the governor proposing to expand them, this committee in the next couple of weeks will have to make a determination on this issue as well. So if Mr. Michael, if you wouldn't be willing to just discuss the whole bucket a little bit in a way we can think about this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I sort of haven't come prepared to do that. I think there's maybe a little bit of additional information that I can provide that might be useful in providing context to respond to Representative Carlson's question. The tax increment financing law has, since its inception, contained an explicit provision that requires the approving municipality to make an explicit but-for finding that essentially that project wouldn't have happened at that site without the assistance that's being provided. There are various iterations on that. The Jobs E program really is somewhat of a different creature than tax increment, and it's really hard to characterize it because it's, in my judgment, sort of morphed. It started out as an analog of the Michigan-Pennsylvania programs, which are classic enterprise zone programs, the idea being to select a handful of very depressed economic areas and give a lot of essentially government benefits to lure businesses to locate there, because the premise was that there were a lot of underemployed sort of both public resources like public infrastructure and a labor pool. During the legislative process, the program really morphed into something different, in my judgment, and that something different is that it's now sort of a general economic development tool for rural Minnesota. And I think that's sort of the story that you're hearing now. I mean, philosophically, you probably need to face sort of a fundamental question initially is, what's the appropriate role of government in terms of sort of attempting to create economic activity either in some places or across the state as a whole? Is that a legitimate function of state government? I mean, this really is the tax committee, and so it's sort of not really your normal purview. That would be sort of the economic development committee. But once you reach that threshold question and say, yes, we think that is the case, then you have to sort of say, well, what's the most effective and efficient way to do that, and is this that? I guess beyond that, I'm not, you know, sort of prepared to give you more advice or context than that.
Thank you for your indulgence, everyone. I just think it, your testifiers and Representative Nornes and everyone should know that it's hard to not hear a community and stay thinking about the big policy. So we did, I think it's just helpful for us to think about, because there is a lot of action on that,
Madam
this
Chair,
issue in the next couple of weeks.
Yes. I know you have a long agenda, and we've probably taken a fair amount of time here already, but I just want to say that everyone, I think, sitting on this committee would agree that we hear a lot about outsourcing, we're losing jobs to foreign countries, to wherever it is. I see that this is one area that has been working, and we'll continue to work, I think, to, again, level that playing field a little bit so we can compete with India and we can compete with these other places when it comes to the bottom line. And I think what we've proven with this one company is that even other companies in our own country can realize if they move their companies to rural Minnesota, there's a major savings, just major savings up front, not even counting Jobs E for locating So it's an incentive to get them to look and see what really we have to offer, whether it's up on the range or in my part of the state. It takes an incentive for them to really look seriously at what we have to offer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we think about this topic philosophically, I would hope that we'd keep in mind that Minnesota is not an island. That when it, you know, if we're only dealing with talking about what happens within the state, we might have a different view than if we recognize that we're in business to compete with our neighboring states, neighboring country, and indeed the whole world. I mean, we all know that more and more we're competing in a global market, and what happens and what's available in India is affecting jobs here, et cetera. And so, you know, as we think about in an ideal world, philosophically, maybe we shouldn't do something like this. But we're not an island, and we're faced with the competition of neighboring states, neighboring countries, and the whole world.
Other questions from committee members? Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify for or against House File 1229? 830, sorry. Oh, that's Representative Demmer. Representative Simpson moves House File 830. We do have a quorum. And if there's nothing else, then I will lay over House File 830 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you for coming
down today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Demmer's next. We do have some members who have people who have to get back to where they came from as well. So if you're in that situation, if you could send a note down to Sarah or Jamie to let us know that. Representative Demmer moves House File 1229.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, as we look at taxation, at the beginning of the session, we had a presentation, I think, from Mr. Michael that talked about parameters of taxation and things that we should be thinking about as we look at the whole concept of taxation. One of the things that stuck in my mind was simplicity and the ability of not only us as legislators, but business people and the citizens in general to understand what our taxation policies are, when they're taxed, when they're not taxed, that sort of thing. House File 1229 goes directly to, I believe, that issue on all fronts, whether it's a business or whether it's a consumer, even us as legislators, to be perfectly honest about it. I don't know if I can go so far as to say the analysts. I think they seem to understand this. But, Madam Chair and members, House File 1229, very simply, what it does is undo two things that were done, one in 2001. In the year 2001, and Ms. Dalton, if you would, if I say something wrong, would you just kind of wink or do something at me? But back in 2001, we enacted sales tax on installation charges, in other words, labor, a certain type of labor. And we have not gone toward, we have not taxed, put sales tax on labor expenses. In this case, we did in 2001. That was labor on installing a new item of some sort. And then we heard that, well, that's not fair to the people selling new stuff because somebody will buy an item from one person and have somebody else come and install it. So in 2002, we said, well, we're going to tax third-party installers, too, to make sure we have a level playing field for installers. Well, think about a scenario, and I'm going to use the computer industry, and I had a constituent who had planned to come and testify, and he's going to sell something today and couldn't come. And I said, that's fine. You add to the economy. I'll do the talking. A scenario where you purchase a brand-new computer system. Let's say you're either in a business or you're home. Let's say you're a business. You purchase a new computer system, and you have that vendor bring that computer system in, set it up, install it, install your application system, maybe install your antivirus. And then while they're there, you say, well, as long as you're here and you got some time this afternoon, we got these other systems that need tuning up. The antivirus is not current on this one. Could you check into that one? This one's locking up quite a bit, and this one can't access the network. Could you look into those for me, too? Well, in that scenario, Madam Chair and members, there's two sets of labor that need to be kept track of. The labor for installing the new system is taxable under our current law, and the labor for doing the work on the other systems that you came, that you were asked to do, is not taxable. And I would submit to you that we have a large, and you can expand this into lots of different labor installing type of things, whether it's consumer electronics, whether it's appliances, whatever. where you have somebody come and do an installation for a new item versus coming and doing work on an old item, that labor is sometimes taxable, sometimes not. And I would defy you to go back to your districts and talk to, I would challenge you to go back to your districts and talk to anybody who does this kind of work. Ask them how they treat the sales tax on labor installation of new items. And I'd be very curious to find out if you don't get a blank stare and say, what are you talking about? Now, some might know it, and I'll tell you, the ones who know about it are the ones who probably had an audit and got to pay in. Because my constituent that was going to come here is one of those people. He got a sales tax audit. He had everything. His ducks are in a row. He's a computer guy, and they got computerized records. He didn't know that this was the case. And he did have somebody in his staff that might have known. He didn't even know for sure. But he's got multiple salespeople out, multiple installers out doing these sorts of things. They didn't understand that they had to keep track of installing new stuff versus used stuff. And he got trapped, ended up costing him, I think he settled for $7,000, $8,000 is what he ended up owing in sales taxes or whatever. And he was going to come in and testify about that. But anyway, the long and short of it, members, is I understand the fiscal impact. I think you all got a fiscal impact sheet, don't you? It shows that it's like $23 million in 08, and it's like $26 million in 09. It's got a pretty hefty price tag. But, you know, as we look at, Madam Chair, as we look at our taxation policies, I'd like to think we can find some way, if it'd be nice things, clean this all up and just take care of it. Because I really think that we're making very honest business people, and especially that after they're charged of levying this, violate the law. And they're setting themselves up for being liable for some expense. Primarily the ones who are going to get hurt by this are the vast majority of small business owners who don't have tax experts on their staff, that don't even probably have strong fiscal people that work for them. They may have part-time bookkeepers. Maybe they have a tax guy who does their taxes and doesn't do those sorts of things as far as the tax policy. So, members, I guess this is in the sake of simplicity and for the sake of our constituents out there who we trust with trying to enact some of these sales tax type of policies that we have. This needs to be addressed. I think we need to, I don't know, Madam Chair, if we can do this in our budget or not. It'd be the best if we could just clean it back up again. But you know, and I wouldn't support this, quite frankly, but maybe we just go to taxing labor and then we need to clean it up. But I think, and I wouldn't support that, Representative Solberg. I saw the smile.
You were saying.
But, you know, bottom line is, you know, it's a problem. And I know we have to address lots of problems, but I felt obligated and very strongly to bring this up. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about it, Madam Chair, and I'll open any questions.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? If not, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Demmer, is this a note from revenue? Does that assume that we're collecting the tax from everyone who is required to pay it? Or is it an estimate of what we're actually now collecting? Or is somebody from revenue?
There's someone from revenue in the room.
I can't find it, Madam Chair.
Well, does Ms. Dalton want to take a shot? It's not her work. We don't want to blame her. And we don't want to praise her either way. It's actually the Department of Revenue. Ms. Dalton, you want to take a shot at what you think's going on there?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the general practice of the department when they're making revenue estimates is to assume 100% compliance. They're pretty explicit in their revenue notices if they are not assuming 100% compliance.
Well, Madam Chair, that's what I would have thought, but I doubt very much we're collecting anywhere near that amount. And so to be scared off by a revenue note that we're not now collecting seems to me to be not very smart. And so I think we ought to really challenge the department to give us more of an analysis here as to what we're really actually collecting. And I'm sure we're not collecting anywhere near that amount.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. And without the department here, we'll get them to answer that at a later date. I'm going to guess the answer is because our forecasts are based on growth in sales and income. It is a model that presumes the economy will grow and sales tax receipts will increase, as will income. So I guess they'd have to forecast differently if they were going to do the revenue estimate differently. But we can have them talk to us about that another day. Representative Demmer, anything else? And Representative Demmer has raised this issue, as committee members know, since the beginning of session. I agree with you that we should either tax it all or not tax it all. We appreciate you taking the time to do it in a bill, and we will consider it.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for giving me the platform to be able to spout off about this a bit. I really appreciate it. And, just as a second thought regarding that, it would be also interesting to find out if in their, and I should have thought of this before, but when they do their audits, we can find out how much of their auditing they find this sort of thing causing people to have to pay in. I don't know if they keep track of why people are short, if they do find shortages in sales tax, but my hunch is this would be a pretty significant amount of it. So, again, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
members.
You,
I appreciate
and I will
chance.
Lay over House File 1229. Thank you, Representative Demmer. Representative Dabney moves House File 1204. And I believe Representative Dabney has testifiers if they want to just join us. A lot of bills here.
I think we'll be coming up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. He did wish to testify but also be able to move on his day. You know, your closing comments on Representative Demmer's bill may be the good place to start. You said, you know, kind of we should either tax it all or not tax it all. And here, this is about not taxing it all with the emphasis on all. House File 1204 is almost technical in nature. Since 2001, any owner of affordable housing is exempt from paying sales tax on construction materials used for construction or improvement of the property. This includes a nonprofit developer, a public housing agency, a housing redevelopment authority, a privately owned public housing, and a limited partnership where the general partner is a public housing authority or a housing redevelopment agency. The only category excluded from the exemption, we should either tax it all or not tax it all, is a nonprofit acting as a sole or managing general partner within a limited partnership using low-income housing tax credits. Low-income housing tax credits are the most common tool used to develop affordable rental housing. This bill would extend the sales tax exemption to the project it was originally intended to assist, would save about $2,700 per unit, and per new unit, I should say, and $1,900 per rehabbed unit. Fiscal note is only $1.32 million for the 08-09 biennium. And I have with me Mr. Alan Arthur, President of the Central Community Housing Trust, who can explain in greater detail the complexity of the financing packages that allows nonprofits to develop affordable rental housing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today. Again, my name is Alan Arthur, and I'm the President of Central Community Housing Trust, and we are a nonprofit provider of affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. And we are one of the leading producers of affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. We've been around since 1986. We have 1,432 apartment homes for low-income families and individuals in our state. In 1986, the federal government, because affordable housing was becoming an increasing problem in our country, passed what was called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, colloquially, Section 42 of the IRS Code, which gives folks who have income to have income and taxes, the right to reduce their taxes by taking advantage of this tax credit program. And basically it works simply like this. The federal government gives to each state the right to allocate so many credits. The state has those credits and allocates them to eligible projects, basically hands them over to folks who are doing the kinds of eligible affordable housing projects that the state wants to have produced. We are one of those kinds of folks who do those kinds of projects. We take that piece of paper that says that someone has the right to take a tax break or a tax reduction, and we go out and find an investor, or sometimes and most often actually a group of investors, who want to buy that piece of paper. We hand the piece of paper over to them. They hand us the money in return. They, for example, get on an annual basis perhaps $500,000 of the tax credit over a 10-year period, federal tax credit over a 10-year period. In return, we get approximately $5 million, depending on the situation at the time, $5 million, say, of capital to help actually make the project happen. That capital typically provides somewhere around 50% plus or minus of the total capital needed for the project. It is, right now, and has been since 1986, the number one production tool for affordable housing in the country that exists. Again, 50% of the total capital of a project. Now, there are other benefits besides just the capital. It doesn't, something else that's sometimes hidden that I'll mention because I think is important, and that is it connects corporations in our communities to the issue of affordable housing and to the understanding that it needs to be met, and I think it helps improve the overall environment for it. In this particular state, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, your state agency for affordable housing, is the allocator of those tax credits and also regulates and monitors how they're used, who's invested in them, who the partners are, who the folks like us are who produce them. So your state agency monitors that. Again, it's a powerful tool. When the state of Minnesota approved in 2001 this sales tax exemption, we were excited because it allowed us to help cover some of the other 50% over and above this tax credit piece. But unfortunately, it did not include nonprofits as one of the categories who are general partners or managing general partners in one of these limited partnerships that we put together so we can get the piece of paper in that. Again, we have seen it as an oversight, and we hope, Madam Chair and representatives, that can be corrected in this session. With that, I guess I can answer any technical questions you might have about the low-income housing tax credit, how it's used in the state of Minnesota, or how we use it in our organization, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Arthur. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against this legislation? Questions from committee members? If not...
Madam Chair.
Representative Abney.
In oversight on my part, a small oral amendment, if I may?
Yes.
On page 1, line 18... After the word sole, insert or managing. After the word sole, insert the words or managing.
Does House Research, you have that? You got that? Do members all understand that?
Can I simply incorporate that? Or do we need a vote?
Yes, you can. You can.
Thank you very much.
We need to vote on it.
We need to, okay.
We do. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And Representative Dabney renews his motion for House File 1204 as amended, and I will lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Mr. Arthur, for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Thank you. Members. Representative Welty. And members, I'm going to make some motions here as Representative Welty comes down to honor some commitments the tax committee gave to some authors. We heard some of their tax credit bills when we did not have their possession. We heard them as informational hearings, and we promised then that as they came into our possession, we would move them and lay them over. And so I will move House File 123. That was Representative Slawick's pre-K tax credit bill. We heard that, and I will lay that over for possible inclusion. I will also move House File 1264. That was Representative Eastland's early childhood education grant tax credit bill, which we had a hearing on, and I will lay that over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. We additionally heard Representative Thiessen's House File 20, which was a pre-K scholarship tax credit bill. We had those hearings, and I will lay that over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I'm also going to right now remove House File 2362 from today's agenda. I will also remove House File 1737 from today's agenda, and we'll announce that Representative Rood's House File 1950 will move down to tonight. With that, we're going to go to Representative Welty, House File 1501. Would someone like to move Representative Welty's bill for him?
So move.
Representative Marquardt moves House File 1501. Welcome to the committee, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to members of the committee. House File 1501 is a bill that exempts all home heating fuels from sales tax. Currently, your natural gas, as you can read, hot water, propane gas, steam, wood, coal, are exempt from sales tax. But we have a couple new fuels that are coming online. Those include corn, regular corn, wood pellets, and biofuel pellets. And so what we originally did when we were putting together the bill is that we actually spelled out that corn would be exempt if you used it for home heating fuel, wood pellets would be exempt. But we, in consultation with the Department of Revenue, they asked us just to put in a bill that says that all home heating fuels would be exempt so that as we move forward into the future, if a new type of renewable fuel comes online that can be used for home heating fuel, that would also be included. So we didn't have to come back time and time and time again to exempt home heating fuels from the sales tax. And so that's the bill. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Sue Kruger from Plainview, Minnesota, who just got into the biofuels business and is selling corn to people who are burning it in their corn stove. So with that.
Welcome, Ms. Kruger.
Oh, thank you. In August, we started our business as we're farmers, and we farm 4,000 acres in southeast Minnesota. But we were asked by two other stove dealers to start a corn supplying, biomass supplying business where we would deliver corn directly to the homeowners and the businesses. And it has turned into quite an adventure business-wise and is going quite well. We started out with the goal we wanted to reach 50 people. We reached 70 people in our first year starting in August. So in this heating season, we reached 70 retail. We have taken on 70 retail customers. 90% of them are residential, and 10% of them are businesses. We have networked through stove dealers, and we wanted to have at least 12 stove dealers as dealers for our fuel, and we have picked up 16. So as you can see, this is a fruitful thing. It is going forward, and we're very proud of what we do. We produce corn, we dry it, and we clean it, and then we also mix the corn with various pellets, wood and agra pellets. Agra pellets are made from crop waste. They are a new invention that's being pushed quite heavily. I just returned from Reno, Nevada last, it's been 2 weeks now, and I was at the Pellet Fuels Institute. That's where I, it's one of the associations we belong to. And we listened to Congressman Johnson from Pennsylvania and another congressman from Texas, and they're really pushing biomass pellets to heat homes. So I see that this is going to be something on the forefront that's going to just only grow and grow. It is our passion to pursue energy independence at Eagle Biofuels. That's the name of our company. We chose an eagle because that shows liberty from fossil fuels, and we think it's very important to sustain this earth with having a CO2 neutral fuel, giving back renewable every year with biomass and corn. And so we think that the next generation at least deserves this, and it shouldn't be taxed. We personally heat our whole farm with corn, as do many other farmers that are really catching on to, but they use their own product. The average homeowner with a 2,000 square foot home can heat their house for $900 a winter, so about $180 a month. If we tax them, it's another $60 to $100, you know, basing on that. Blend on, and as far as our products, we blend the corn with the hardwood pellets and with the agri pellets, so there's more expansion into that area. As I came back from the Institute meeting, when wood pellets came out in 1995, 600,000 tons were sold in 1995. That's when they first hit the market big, and they kept tracking them. Now, this last year, they sold 1.2 million tons of wood pellets. So that has doubled. And that's what we foresee to happen with corn and the biomass pellet in the next 10 years. In our state, I do believe there's five other corn delivery services. And I do know of two online catalogs that you can order bagged corn for corn burning stoves and also pellets. I know our company is the only one that is blending the corn and the agri pellets together. And in closing, and Minnesota is definitely is the leader in alternative energy. I have researched and we do deliver in Iowa and Wisconsin, and we collect sales tax also in those states. They, too, are charging sales tax on corn and biomass heating fuels. And I would like to see Minnesota, again, be the leader in exempting sales tax on corn and biomass fuels for heating purposes and provide an incentive to Minnesota consumers to go green and use biomass and corn and things that are renewable every year and avoid fossil fuels. It is true that heating your home is probably one of the least expensive things that you can do go green versus driving a car or so forth. Heating your home is probably the least smallest investment. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify either for or against House File 1501? Questions from committee members? If not, Representative Welty, we appreciate it. And did you have any closing comments as we lay your bill over?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd just ask you to give this serious consideration as you're putting together the tax bill for the purpose and the reason of this. As we look at how people are heating their homes, we're trying to make it affordable for them, so we've exempted sales tax on the other fuels that they're using. Well, we have new fuels coming online. Number one, these new fuels are good for the environment. In the Energy Committee, I can tell you that we're making a major push towards carbon sequestration, cutting down on the greenhouse gas emissions. This is one way that we can move towards that. The other thing is, in greater Minnesota, and I know this is even catching on in the urban areas, people are moving towards renewable and alternative fuels. This has really been taking off, and people are moving to these fuels because they're actually cheaper than heating with your fuels that are on the market today, whether that be your petroleum-based products or something else. So people are trying to offset their costs. They're trying to save money by going to these alternative fuels. And if people are going to be going to these, I think that they should have the same sales tax exemption as they get with the petroleum-based products.
Representative Wolschlager.
Chair members, Representative Welty, I have sat at many fairs in Goodhue and Wabasha County and have been sandwiched in between any number of these, machines that burn corn, et cetera. My question is, and just talking to fair people and being at the fair, there's been some issues with city ordinances. And can you talk about that, of where neighbors have complained that there's been storage of corn? And you're looking like you've never heard this. So
I can address that question. A lot of our corn is delivered in bags and is stored in the garage. And there are cities that have ordinance against bulk tanks. Right now there's various companies designing bulk tanks that look like almost like a hot tub, on stakes, so it looks aesthetically well for the yard. I know people have been concerned about rodents, and as long as you keep your bags or your things sealed and you pick up every speck, you will not be collecting rodents because they have to see it in order to get it. We at our farm, of course, have a large rodent problem because there are pluckets, but I do not foresee this to be a problem. I can tell you we have neighborhoods that have like 3 corn-burning stoves in the neighborhood. Our truck pulls in, and the people and our customers get just like a dolly. We dolly like the Pepsi man has in the store. We dolly the bags of corn or pellets into their garages, and they're stored in there, and it's their duty to fill their stoves. There's also bulk. Our bulk delivery service blows it into the bulk tank, and the dust comes out the other side, and it's very contained. I do not, in the future, see that being a problem. I think it will only get better as this market expands because there's more people inventing bulk storage that looks aesthetically well and will be weather and rodent proven.
Thank you. And Representative Welty, I'm going to lay over House File 1501, and thank you for your bill, and thank you for your testifier.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Members, we have 27 minutes, and we are going to hear Representative Peterson next. We're going to get through Representative Swales, Fowles, Slocum, and Erickson in 27 minutes. Representative Erdahl has asked to be moved to tonight, as has Representative Heikerken, and I wanted to ask Representative Dill, can we take you tonight, or do we need to get you done in the next 27 minutes, too?
Well, I got two omnibus bills of mine up tonight in another committee, so it's up to you. Okay, I can do mine very quickly.
We'll keep it short.
Okay,
Representative Peterson and Representative Coonan moves House File 1613. Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to, I guess, propose to delete Section 2 right away.
Do you have an amendment here? This oral?
No, I just, the oral, yeah.
Representative Coonan moves. You know, I'm making Representative Coonan move something. He's not here, is he?
Yeah.
I'll just have to take that back, and I'll have Representative Yarrows moves the bill. First of all, House File 1613, I'll make that correction. And Representative Yarrows now moves the amendment for Representative Peterson, which is to delete Section 2. Are there questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor? Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. It's now in the form you'd like it. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Lucheski. I will propose then, after Representative Welty, to exempt from the sales tax the actual stove that burns the fuel that he just referred to. So I'd appreciate if you consider that in your tax bill.
Nicely done. That was really great.
That's the best way to do a bill.
Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against this bill? Are there questions from committee members? Representative Simpson.
Just a quick question. Do we do this with any other kind of heating systems?
Thank you for that question, Representative Simpson. I was actually sending a note off to Ms. Dalton and Mr. Michael to. Right. I was thinking the same thing about electric generation facilities and things of the like, as noted in the bill. But Ms. Dalton, maybe you could give the committee an answer on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, the answer is no.
Thank you for the question. Other questions? If not, thank you for your patience, Representative Peterson, and I will lay over this House file for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Yarrows.
I was just wondering if we have somebody from out of town, from Pine County and St. Louis County, if they could get on before tonight.
Oh, thank you.
For Faust, yes. We're going to get through Faust by 2 o'clock here. So thank you, Representative Peterson. We're moving Representative Rude to tonight. That was next. Then we're moving Representative Heikerken to tonight. Next, we're going to get to Representative Swales. And let's see, Representative Tilbury moves House File 1516 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Swales, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am just going to hand this over to our county commissioner and our county engineer from Washington County.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Friesel. I currently serve as chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. With me today is Don Tyson, who is our Director of Transportation and Physical Development. I'd like to take the opportunity of thanking Representative Swales for authoring this important bill on behalf of Washington County, and also thank the committee for hearing it. I have three brief points I would like to make, and then I would turn it over to Don so he can give you an overview of the project. My three brief points are: our project will save the state money by consolidating the courts to our campus. Savings come from being able to centralize security, staff, files, and transport of folks in custody. It's a county project that's actually going to save the state money. The second point I'd like to make: this is the largest courts expansion construction project in Minnesota the last 10 years, and likely will remain the largest in the next 10 years. The bill will save an estimated $1.6 million of Washington County taxpayers' money, property owners. This savings will be used for courts technology to make this an even better project for the state. The state courts have no money for technology on this project. The third point I'd like to make: this is a project that benefits more than just Washington County taxpayers. Any Minnesota resident who has court business here benefits. This project should not be 100% reliant on property taxes. We look for our partners to help support us on this. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Tyson. I'm the Washington County Engineer. Real quickly, the handout you have is the architect's rendering of what is going to be built. The primary features of this are a three-story addition on our current law enforcement center. That's where an arraignment courtroom will be and provides a lot of efficiency for the state. Prisoners can come right up out of the jail into the courtroom. Also, a new modern 911 call center. You also will see a five-story courts addition. We're going to be building 12 courtrooms with just finishing six of them, so we have six for the future. And all the judges there will be also housed and plenty of room for expansion. And then finally, there's going to be remodeling of the existing courts. And a big feature, two big features of that is going to be creating a juvenile and family area that's a growing area in the court system, and it'll be a proper facility for that function. And also one security point, one checkpoint, one place for folks to go through. So instead of having to have three X-ray machines, as an example, spread across the county at different courts, all the court security will be here on this campus, and that creates some of the efficiency for the state on long-term operating costs. Recognizing you're short on time, certainly we could take more detailed questions, but it's a state function, it's a county project, and we appreciate your support on this.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair and sir, is this building strictly courthouses, period?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it isn't. There are other components of expansion that deal with community services
and the jail. How much of this is the expansion, is the request for the entire courthouse that's being built?
Done.
Madam Chair, Representative, the picture here is the final full campus. The one large five-story building here is the courts project. That project itself is about $25 million. The three-story addition on the law enforcement center is another $15 million. A little bit of the remodel is for community corrections. Except for the 911 call center, the project really is for the related to the court system and the state court function in Washington County.
I'm sure. I think we just need a little bit more of clarification at some point of related to, because lots of things are related to courts. And it's one thing to have a court itself, the courtroom itself, but then some of the other functions may not be directly related. Okay, if we can have some clarification would help.
Madam Chair, we can provide that detail.
Yes, and we'll work with Representative Swales to get that, and members of the Tax Committee know we have done some of these in the past, and we've looked for that separation. Is there anyone else in the public who would like to testify for or against? Any other questions? Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that we have done this in the past on a limited basis, but I think that we as a tax committee, if we're going to continue this again, we're looking at broad-based. We have 87 counties, and I have two counties right now talking the same proposal, so be prepared for Becker and Otter Tail County to be here next year, so just keep that in mind.
Thank you for that reminder, Representative Simpson. Other questions? If not, we appreciate you taking the time to be here, and we thank you, Representative Swales, and I will lay this open for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Faust and Representative Solberg moves House File 1784. Representative Faust and members, we are going to get to Representative Reinert, Slocum, who else sent me a note, and Atkins by two. There's someone else, send a note down. Welcome to the committee, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, and thank you for hearing this bill. We appreciate it. I have with me two county commissioners from Pine County, Roger Nelson and Doug Carlson. I will real briefly discuss the situation, and there is a change that we want to make to this, but I'll explain the change and let somebody above my pay scale figure out how to word that, if that's okay. This revolves around a new courthouse that Pine County had to build. There was a judge from the 10th Judicial District that said, thou shalt build a new courthouse. The county commissioners proposed a plan that was a little bit over $17 million, and the judge decided that wasn't good enough for various reasons. I don't even know what that was. And they came back with a plan for $30 million, and that was approved, and they are still in the process of constructing that, basically done, but not quite open yet. And so what the change that we'd like to ask for is for the taxes on the part of the judicial district only. the total amount was $30 million, but the part that was for the judicial part that they were forced to change, since they're using this building for a lot of other things, the cost of that part was $3,832,949. And so that is the part that we would like to ask for a tax credit back for. And so I believe that the way the bill reads is the fiscal note is calling for tax credit on over $9 million. And so we're actually asking for significantly less than that. We'll, of course, take anything that you'll give us, but we feel, in fairness, that is really the proper amount that we should ask for. So I'll turn it over these two commissioners to fill in whatever holes I've left out.
Okay, Representative Faust, I'm going to ask Ms. Dalton to work on that amendment for you. We'll get back to it before we lay this over. We are going to get through all those bills soon, so we'll just go to your testifiers. We'll come back and do the amendment.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Roger Nelson, Chairman of the Pine County Board of Commissioners. And again, Roger Nelson, Chairman of the Pine County Board of Commissioners. And just briefly, I want to explain what sets this apart from any other type of courthouse project, because we have 87 counties and they all have courthouses. And the difference is, on this particular project, is that we had a $17 million project proposed and voted on by the commissioners. We were moving forward on that, and that was in essence vetoed by a single judge, and so therefore we had to come back with a $30 million project. That's the difference. We wouldn't be here today if our $17 million project would have been approved. When we look at Pine County, a $30 million project, we're not a large county, less than 30,000 population. That's over $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in Pine County. That's a significant burden on our county, and this little bit of sales tax relief would go a long ways in our county.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee and staff, thanks again for allowing us to plead our case. I did have the good fortune of serving a number of years with you folks down here. I recognize a few of you, and it's a great experience, humbling experience, and I'm thrilled to see that things are moving along quite rapidly. And I've had some discussions in the past, but I served 18 years down here, so it was a little while, and it's a new experience. The only thing I'm going to ask, ma'am, is that I could just say a couple things. Pine County is not a rich county. We belong to a number of the joint powers boards, and in the 2000 data that comes from the Department of Economic Development and Employment people, our median household income in Pine County, household income, was $39,663. Statewide average was $51,202. We're kind of a struggling area. Our median household value in central Minnesota was, in Pine County, was $89,700. That's about $32,000 less than the statewide average, which is just about $121,000. We're a struggling area. The judge, and many of you know him, Judge Quinn, and I still considered him a good friend. He and I had served together here for a number of years. We think he overextended his role in ordering us to do this project. We did not challenge it in court, but we think that since this was an ordered situation, we think that maybe you could give us favorable consideration. We're only asking for the court portion, and we're not after the whole project. We'd appreciate your help, and I want to thank Representative Faust for authoring the bill, and be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, former Representative Carlson. And you were, what years were you in the House?
Well, I was first, I'm sorry, I hate to take time. You got more bills.
No, but
we're
giving everyone 10 seconds, but
okay.
You're a former
I'm sorry,
rep.
Ma'am. Madam Chair, I was first elected in 1970 with Governor Wendy Anderson, Roger Moe, Florian Chmielewski. I don't think there were any of you around.
Maybe.
Oh, Lynn, were you here in 70?
Carlson.
72. Yeah, see, that's what I thought. I mean, I was here quite a while. I lost, and a guy by the name of Roy Carlson beat me.
Carlson?
Yeah. I came back, and then in 1990, a former representative, former Senator Becky Laurie defeated me. And I never thought I'd be back in the political arena, but here you are, and I'm already announcing that I won my last election. First time in 13 public campaigns I didn't have an opponent. And so I'm running for retirement, so I just thank you folks for the opportunity to appear.
Well, thank you for that aside. We're going to hear from Representative Carlson and Yaros, but first I would like to have Representative Solberg will move. For Representative Faust, chair the amendment, I'd like to read it. Representative Solvert moves to amend House File 1784 as follows. Page 1, line 9, after A, insert up to 3,833,000 in. And that should do, that should take care of the amendment that Representative Faust was looking for. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I was only going to say, being that we're reminiscing a bit, that in addition to the Carlsons you mentioned, Arne Carlson, the future governor, was in at that point. But there was an article in the paper about the loss of the number of Johnsons in the legislature. They're down to one.
Oh.
And at one time, there were five Carlsons, and we used to joke about introducing a bill that would have been Carlson, 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 and Carlson. But I don't know if we would have ever reached an agreement on what the bill might have been.
Thank you. We had
a mixed delegation.
Thank you for that. Representative Yaros.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just going to suggest that if we run out of money to fund this, we could deduct it from the 10th Judicial District budget. I mean, wouldn't that be appropriate?
Madam Chair, Representative Jarls, I just completed jury duty, and I don't want those judges mad.
Thank you for that. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Nelson or Commissioner Carlson, what were the reasons why you decided not to challenge the judge's ruling in a higher court?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I was chairing at the time. Judge Quinn had personally interviewed every single one of the commissioners. I personally did not attempt, because I was not confident I would have three votes, to move to the courts, even though I believed strongly in my heart authority had been overstepped between the judicial and the legislative branch. And so therefore we lived with the consequences, and we've done the best we can. There comes a time in politics when you say, how hard do you fight for something, or when do you finally try and say it's time to move on? But we did have this recourse to come with potential legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess on the same point Representative Lanning just brought up, I mean, there's a September 8, 2003 memorandum from the judge at the time that says the role of the courts, and it said Minnesota law gives courts the power to approve or disapprove county plans, but then it goes on and says this does not mean the courts can substitute their judgment for the political judgment properly resting with the county. So, I mean, even in here, he basically says if you wanted to, you could have probably overruled what he had to say. And I agree with Representative Yaros that maybe the district court should be paying for the extra $13 million that it took. But I'm just wondering why there wasn't more push on the county part to say, unless you thought there was more that needed to be done in the court's plan.
I'll be very candid, Madam Chair. I'll let the chair speak if he wants. But I felt it was time to cut losses. It was bitter. It was ugly, folks. When personalities, and any of you that know Judge Quinn, a brilliant person, but when you start to clash personalities, I don't think it's helpful to the public or to the elected officials.
Thank you. Do you want to comment, Chair Nelson? No. Okay. Are there any other questions? Anyone else from the public who would like to speak either for or against. If not, we will lay over your bill, Representative Fowles. Thank you, and thank you to your testifiers.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just a quick note. Will we get a new revenue estimate on this amendment then?
We're going to be announcing, we're actually going to do an email to all members that folks who amend their bills as they come through taxes, and there have been many, it's going to be their responsibility that the revenue to request the Department of Revenue to get us a new estimate, because as we put the omnibus tax bill together and as members on both sides of the aisle offer amendments, they have to be in balance. We have to know what they cost. But we will be getting that out to every member of the Minnesota House.
Madam Chair, if I could just give you a rough ballpark, it would be about $240,000.
Thank you. And, you know, Representative Solberg, he's going to need to see that. Even though you just told him, he's going to need to see that piece of paper. So thank you for that, Representative Faust.
That's okay.
Yes, thank you. And now, Representative Reinert, welcome to the committee. And Representative, I will move, House File 2060.
For sure.
Thank you for your patience. Members, we want to do this, and Slocum, Atkins, and Dill, still before we adjourn. Representative Reiner, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing us today. I don't think you'd be surprised to hear that this is a sales tax exemption in the third court facility. I hope that's not three strikes and you're out. The only way to make this unique might be by a little musical accompaniment or a tap dance, but I'm not going to volunteer to do that. Yet from our perspective in Blue Earth County, this project is exciting and unique. After several years of saving, discussing, and planning, we're moving forward with a joint function justice center that includes a direct supervision style jail, along with our courts, law enforcement, prosecution, and probate. With maximum commitment to energy savings and environmental concerns, the building will be LEED certified. That's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. The first to be so in South Central Minnesota. The community is committed and excited as we move to break ground this spring. With that introduction, I'd like to turn this over to Blue Earth County's Administrator, Dennis McCoy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The current courthouse in Blue Earth County was designed and constructed in the 1880s and no longer serves the needs of a contemporary justice system. Therefore, we're moving to replace it, and I need to clarify or emphasize that the request this afternoon pertains only to the court's portion of the building, not to the Sheriff's Department, the County Attorney, probation, or any other portion of the structure. We're really concerned with addressing that in that the courts in the 5th Judicial District were assumed by the state of Minnesota back several years ago. We will be providing a very robust technological environment for these courtrooms so that the future is well planned and the building will operate very efficiently. We're talking 4 courtrooms and a formal hearing room that will be constructed as part of this effort. And we hope to break ground early next month.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy. Are there questions for Mr. McCoy or Representative Briner? Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? And Representative Briner, you should know that Blue Earth and others you've heard, we've heard a few of these this year, and so we're pretty familiar with why you would like this exemption, and we appreciate you taking the time to be here. If there are no other questions, I will then lay over House File 2060, and thank you, Representative Briner.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Dill, can I go to Representative Slocum first? She has to get to a committee for, I don't know, something more important than us, Representative Dill. I'm not sure. No, come on down, Representative Slocum. Let's see, Representative Atkins moves House File 2208. And welcome, Representative Slocum. Did you have anyone from Richfield who wanted to join us? Just you.
On advice.
No problem. You don't need anybody. We like that, actually.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Slocum.
I will be very brief, Madam Chair.
Fire away.
Could someone move my...
I think Representative Atkins did.
Wonderful. Yeah, did. Terrific. Thank you so much. As with a lot of the bills that you've heard, everybody's here. We want a tax exemption from the building supplies. And I thought, how do I make this different? And a tap dance really isn't up my alley. The electric slide is more my thing. Or, you know, a can-can. I used to be on the dance line in my high school, a little known fact. But anyway, and then I thought, you know, no, I'm just going to tell you exactly why, because there are some things that stand out about Richfield City Hall that I know because I was a citizen member of their Community Services Commission. A number of years ago, there were people who were complaining about some health issues and that seemed to be aggravated working there. And they looked things over, and they found that the building was pretty well riddled with mold. They went back and forth, debated, do we do mold abatement? Do we spend that kind of money, or given the age of the building and given our community's growth, projected growth, do we just take it down and build a new building? And after much consideration, and I was part of that consideration, and I think it was good, well-balanced, thorough consideration, they decided to build a new facility. I'm coming today here to ask for a tax refund, rebate, whatever you want to call it, for the building supplies for that building. I don't know that my Richfield city manager would have told you that mold story, but that's the reason behind the building. Although I will tell you, I know my city council people look at that Bloomington City Hall nearby, and they do go, oh, you know. So, but the real reason for the rebuild is the mold issue. So that's it. Do you have any questions, committee? I'd be happy to answer whatever you have. I also, if you don't have a financial impact statement, I have one here.
We've got
one. You've got one?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good.
Representative Slocum, having personally spent been in the Richfield City Hall a number of times, you are right. You need a new city hall. There is no doubt about that. And I think that for members who maybe don't live in the metro, the first ring suburbs, it's time. The second ring and third rings, like I represent, have a little bit different net tax capacity situation. And I know when the Bloomington City Hall was built, it was actually dubbed the Taj Mahal by the Minnesota Taxpayers League.
However,
the governor, when he has been there a few times, he hasn't thought it so bad. So I do think, though, that if for members who've never been to Richfield City Hall, it is an aging facility, and it's time for them to get a new city hall. So we appreciate you bringing the bill before us. Is there anyone from the public, either for or against, to testify? Any questions from members? If not, I will lay over your bill. Representative Slocum, thank you for your patience. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Representative Dill moves House File 928.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dill.
This bill is to reclassify clay targets that are thrown from a launching machine by a gun club or any place that does this and resells them to the public as a how do they phrase this, as a sale that is taxable. Problem is that right now the gun clubs, which are located unilaterally all over the state, every district has these, they have to pay sales tax on them when they buy them, and then they have to pay then the customer has to pay sales tax on them when they sell them to them. So I mean that we're taxing it twice, which is real good for the state, but it doesn't seem fair. And I know that when we go to the gun club, we pay sales tax on the sale of them, and I did not know that the club paid sales tax when they bought them. And so we do have a testifier here, but I mean he would tell you the same thing. His company buys the targets, pays sales tax, and then when he sells them to us or any of you, he charges you sales tax. So we're getting a real fine deal on this, and I think we shouldn't quite get as fine a deal as we have.
Thank you for that, Representative Bill. I don't know if your testifier wanted to join us.
Mr. Moe, are you here? You want to say something?
Please join us at the table if you'd like to. And members know this is the business pyramiding we talk about in the sales tax. It is rife throughout the sales tax. And about 40%, 44 I think, in the most recent tax incident study of the sales tax is paid for by business first in this double taxation or sometimes triple or quadruple method of taxing business input. So this problem is rife throughout the tax code. No testifier? If not, is there anyone from the public? Someone else would like to testify for or against? Questions for Representative Dill? If not, thank you, Representative Dill, and I'll lay over House File 928 for possible inclusion in the items tax.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now Representative Atkins moves House File 1439, and we're gonna jump ahead and do a contraband cigarette tax issue right now, which we're doing the rest tonight, but Representative Atkins needs to be somewhere. So we will be having a little small house overview on tobacco taxes tonight, and we'll take the rest of them then. But Representative Atkins is moving this bill now, and Representative Atkins also moves the A070167 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So you've got the bill in the shape you like. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is not controversial. It's bipartisan in nature. It's been around for a little while. Didn't make it through it last year, mostly because of technical problems that it ran into. But it has everybody's support. Revenue's in support of it. It involves contraband cigarettes. Current law, they are allowed to be sold at auction, destroyed, or given to patients in state institutions. This law would provide that they be destroyed. Everybody's in support of it, and with that, I just stand for any questions you may have.
Questions for Representative Atkins? Testimony either for or against House File 1439.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lanning.
Should we ask if they're burned?
I'm sorry.
Oh, my voice. But
yes, your voice is shot, Representative
yeah, I know.
Lanning.
Should we ask whether they burn the cigarettes?
No, you shouldn't.
Representative Solberg.
Are these strictly unstamped?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, these are contraband cigarettes, unstamped, illegal, shouldn't be used for anything, ought to be destroyed.
Thank you. And Representative Solberg has a bill tonight on stamp cigarettes, so we'll be getting to that. Other questions for Representative Atkins? Representative Simpson.
I have a few questions for Representative Atkins. It could take up to about 27 seconds because he told me it was going to be a 45-second bill, and he's way under. If he calls this a little bit longer, he'll be over his limit. I think that's it. He's done.
Anyone else? If not, I'll lay over House File 1439. Members, we are in recess. What room are we in? We are in room 200, and we are in recess. Thank you, members.
All right. The Tax Committee meeting will reconvene. Representative Heigerton.
Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
The name like Wolfshager, I'm not too sensitive to saying things
good
wrong.
Good German names.
All right.
We'll move it straight to the consent agenda.
don't we call him food poisoning?
Oh, okay.
They'll be coming.
I want to move down here closer to Solberg. Closer. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, this is the minute time.
I drive by that place every time I go back to Solberg.
Representative, are we starting with 1950 or 1791 for House? Doing both, but
thank you. Madam Chair, yeah. We can start with Representative Rood's bill is very similar to mine.
Okay.
And you have heard it before. And I think the pages are handing out. This is from the League of Minnesota Cities, did a write-up on her bill. If you want to pull that out, I think the pages are handing it out. And I'll give you a synopsis of the bill, and I'm just going to read a paragraph and a half of it. They're refreshing your memory. And I know I don't have to do that with Representative Mowry in here. I know that he's got everything right there, and he's. But anyway, if you pick out the capital equipment bill extended, it says on top of the sheet that the pages are handing out. But if you look to the, it refers to Representative Maria Rood's bill there, House File, the House File that we have up here, and it talks about materials used in production process. Capital exemptions when you build a plant. And if you turn to the top right-hand column there, it says the catch is that the city must generally be the actual purchaser and user of the equipment. And this is what happened with the entity with Representative Rood. The city must first pay the tax and then file for a refund using capital equipment refund claim form ST2, which is available from the Department of Revenue. If the city acquires the capital equipment directly, the process to file a refund claim is straightforward. However, when a contractor buys and installs the capital equipment as part of an improvement to real property, the contractor is considered the purchaser and the city would generally not qualify for the sales tax refund unless the city follows a specific process to appoint the contractor as an agent to buy the capital equipment on behalf of the city. The second last paragraph, the League of Minnesota Cities has developed an amendment that would clarify that future capital equipment purchases by a city where a contractor makes the purchase on behalf of the city would be eligible for sales tax refund. And that's basically what Representative Rood's bill will do. Now, the bill that I have here addresses the issue of a private entity got caught into the same gray area where there is a sales tax exemption for materials purchased. However, there's a catch. If there's a contractor involved, the Department of Revenue has on a couple of occasions, one with Representative Rood, one in my particular district with a private entity, and basically what I'm appealing to is the intent of the law. The intent of the law is that this material purchased for construction is sales tax exempt. But because a contractor was involved in a turnkey operation, it was ruled, it's a gray area. And Pat Dalton is here and can explain it very well. And I brought the issue to her last summer. Pat is there, yes. And she said, you're going to need legislation to clarify this. And it's a gray area. But it's a fairness issue. And I have brought with me Mr. Besty that owns a plant in my district, Famo Feeds, and he can explain a little bit about the history of what happened there. In front of you, you have some information on Famo Feeds of what happened there, and I'll address the, also you have a fiscal analysis of what the bill would do if everybody turned in, that everybody that bills in the state of Minnesota would ask for this exemption. This could be the potential cost, but it's like your homestead credit when you do your taxes. If you do it individually, a lot of times you don't file for any homestead credit that you may have. And again, there's a lot of laws that a lot of rebates that people are not aware of. And this is one of them. But again, they did everything in a proper channel. And it was doing a times of fiscal constraint. Usually there's a 30-day, 60-day, 90-day window and in order to get this money back. But being that there was such a shortage of auditors or whatnot, I think it was a year later they heard back. But with that said, I don't want to get into the real fine detail. I'll let Mr. Besty testify on what happened over at Famo Feed. You can ask some questions.
Could I have Representative Marquardt formally move House File 1950?
So move. House File 1950.
Could I have Representative Broad formally move House File 1791?
So move.
Okay. All right.
Thank
For the
you,
record,
Madam Chair.
State your name.
Good evening. My name is Tom Besty, and give you a little background on what happened here. We feel there's ample precedent for a claim. For as many years we have filed claims which have been approved and paid. In fact, this year's claim was partially allowed, however the majority of it was rejected. It is helpful to have an appreciation of the events leading up to our current situation. For a number of years prior to 2002, the Besty family in Freeport, Minnesota owned Freeport Roller Mills and M&B Enterprise of Freeport, Inc. Freeport Roller Mills was located in Freeport, and M&B Enterprise was located in Belgrade, Minnesota. Both companies were engaged in the manufacture of animal feed, primarily dairy feed. This feed was being sold under a common brand called Famo. On July 7th, 2002, the Belgrade plant was struck by lightning, and the plant was destroyed by fire. As a result, 50% or more of the combined manufacturing capacity was lost. Shortly after the fire, the Besty family decided to consolidate the manufacturing of both facilities into a state-of-the-art new facility located in the city of Freeport's yet-to-be-developed industrial park. In fact, Famo was the first tenant in the new park. The corporate structure was changed so that there now only be one legal entity as opposed to two previously. It is now known as Famo Feeds Incorporated. The lost production capacity resulting from the fire was temporarily replaced by having our competitors manufacture it for us using our bags and labels. While we were successful in retaining our customer base, this was not a long-term strategy, as gross margins on the product subcontracted was zero, if not negative. Therefore, it was imperative that the new plant be built on a fast-track basis, as the company did not have the ability to sustain low profit margins for any length of time. The plant was constructed using collaborative services of the Bestie Family Management, architect Graham Muller, and finally J&D Construction Incorporated. Construction meetings were held frequently, often once a week. Decisions were made, duties and responsibilities were assigned. At all times, Mr. Muller and J&D Construction were acting as our agents. The equipment acquired directly by FAMO isn't contested. In fact, FAMO has already received over $4,500 on this refund of this portion of the claim plus interest. The sales tax on the equipment acquired by J&D's Construction on our behalf and the construction on the special purpose building is being contested. This amounts to $88,754. In conclusion, we feel we bought qualifying capital equipment and are wrongfully denied a refund. We have found it necessary to hire an attorney to appeal this, which is costing us money we shouldn't have to spend. We feel this is a ridiculous situation, and we feel cheated and defrauded by the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's pretty much the – it's very similar, as I mentioned, for those of you who came in late, Representative Rood had a bill very similar to this, and she has a bill going forth that addresses this issue as well. And it's one that – it's a very, very gray area. Just because somebody used a contract that had never had possession of the property – the property's always been on Bestie's place, and no notification of any wrongdoing or anything, no intent. The intent of the law was, again, that sales tax, there would be a sales tax exemption on any of these materials, as with any other, you know, any other entity. With that said, I'll open them up to any questions, and Ms. Dalton, I may need your help. Go ahead.
Representative Mulry?
Well, Madam Chair, and maybe Ms. Dalton can answer, but how would you make the cutoff between when the contractor buys it and then installs it in the property and when they buy it just to have it and then install it? How would the tax department know the intent of the contractor, whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, that's actually not an issue with this, because the capital equipment would remain a refund provision, so the tax would be paid at the time that the equipment is purchased, and the user of the equipment under both of these bills would be the person who would apply for the refund. So the contractor wouldn't ever apply for a refund. He would have to provide the information to the user of the capital equipment, so the user, the manufacturer, essentially would apply for the refund on what was paid on the capital equipment. Now, if there could be a potential problem if you go to an upfront capital equipment exemption, because then you may want to continue to have contractors pay the sales tax up front. So if they do a turnkey project, you may still want to have the contractor pay the sales tax up front and have the manufacturer make a refund and only allow an upfront exemption directly for the user purchases.
I'll talk to you. I don't think you understood my question.
I'm sorry.
Any questions from other members? Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? All right. Well, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson?
Here.
Representative Tilbury, would you like to move the bill? House File 1752? Right?
So moved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an amendment, the AO7-0590.
I have that. Does everyone else have it? Would you like to?
I'll make that motion to move this.
All right. Any questions to the amendment? All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. All those opposed?
One to nothing.
All right. Amendment is passed. Representative Erickson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I probably should come to this committee more often and get an amendment passed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, come on.
It was pretty bad today, Representative Solberg. In education, you know. House File 1752 is another request to provide a sales tax exemption. This time it is for Sherburne County, part of which I represent. And I have with me the Public Works Director, John Mentor, who will explain the need for this in Sherburne County.
All right, for the record, state your name, please.
John Mentor, Sherburne County Public Works Director. Madam Chair, Representatives, Sherburne County is proceeding with the construction of a new public works facility. Our total project cost is $11.9 million. Of that, approximately $10.5 million is actual construction and equipment costs. We're estimating approximately 50% of those costs will be materials and equipment. Which is currently subject to sales tax. What we are asking for is an exemption which equals approximately $350,000 to $360,000 in exemptions. What we are actually hoping for is that that is the maximum number, that if the prices come in under budget, that the exemption that we will actually receive will be less than that.
All right. Any questions from members? Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? We're rocking and rolling here, Representative Erickson.
I like it.
Okay. Well, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
I'm chairing committee.
This isn't the rave party yet.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Erdahl?
You're going to play 50.
No, I don't have any. I would think so. All right.
She
knows. I would move.
Representative Solberg. Moves House File 2131. Representative Erdahl, am I going to have to put my glasses on to see that?
Well, Madam Chair, and I'd be glad to show it to you in more detail later. This is the first all-electric farm in the United States. It was my grandfather's farm, and it was powered by Meeker County REA at that time, which is why we're doing this tonight, at least in part. I don't know, maybe the bad news for you members is this is my last bill before the tax committee this year.
Yeah. So moved, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity. Once again, it's always a pleasure to be here. Meeker County Cooperative is a member-owned rural electrical provider serving approximately 8,500 rural member owners in six counties, and they have developed a they were a Job Z project, a commitment was made to them, and then there was some confusion about that commitment, and I will allow Mr. Mergen to explain to you.
All right. For the record, state your name.
Tim Mergen. I'm a general manager of Maker Cooperative Light and Power in Litchfield, Minnesota. And Madam Chair and representatives, just first let me state for the record here that the representative's grandfather always paid his bill on time. Back in 2004, Meeker worked with Deed, the City of Litchfield, the school district, on this whole Job Z. We built a new facility, moved into it in January of 2006. But back in the beginning of 2004, the jobs program was brand new, and basically the rules were being written as we were working with Deed on this program. We went ahead, we signed an agreement in June of 2004. Based on the information provided by Deed, we developed a financial pro forma to pay for the program, to pay for our new facility. In June of 2005, as we're ready building the building, Deed gave us a call and asked for a meeting to come out and meet with us. They also said some people from the Department of Revenue were going to come along. They came out. They met with us, and we were then informed that the Department of Revenue interpreted the sales tax exemption a little bit different than what we were led to believe by Deed as we put everything together. So basically, a year later, we were informed that the rules, if you will, got changed. At that time, it was in 2005, we wound up getting a exemption, if you will, of up to $200,000 for that sales tax exemption during the special session that happened at that time. It was basically we were told that because of the state's dire financial circumstances at that time, that that was all we could get and that we should try next biennium. So we're back here basically asking that our members, the cooperative owners, if you will, be allowed to use that sales tax exemption as they were led to believe when we put the pro forma together. I believe there's a handout for everybody, but I have that information. In 2006, we consumed about $76,000 of that $200,000, so we have $123,000 left. The Job Z program runs through 2015. If we were to extrapolate that out, with inflation factors, we'd be looking at about $681,000 additional. So it's about $75,000 per year.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Solberg?
Madam Chair and sir, how many additional jobs were created with this?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, we did not go into the program under the jobs creation provision. However, in our agreement, we did agree that we would create three new jobs, which we have done.
Madam Chair, tell me a little bit why it was denied from the department. I don't quite understand.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, on all of our equipment, our poles, wires, transformers, that type of thing, when we went into this thing, we were led to believe that any of those type of materials, as long as they were coming into this job zone facility, into our new headquarters, they were going to be sales tax exempt. Well, as a utility, we don't use those things on our site. We use them throughout our entire service territory. Now, a year later, we find out that we cannot get the sales tax exemption on those things because they aren't used right on that site. We take them off site and put them in the ground or whatever, you know, throughout our service territory. So that's where the change came in, was the definition of the use of that sales tax.
I'm sure just a point of clarification then. So this tax exemption sales tax is not on materials that you would use for your building, but materials that insulators, wires, all the other stuff that you are installing throughout the whole territory?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Madam Chair?
Oh, sorry.
You know, Representative Solberg and members, basically Meeker County Co-op, I think, may have been the only utility who was granted this. And the fact, you know, A job, Z provision. The fact is, you know, rightly or wrongly, they later determined that utilities of this type should not get future job Z programs. So I guess, you know, that isn't the issue. The issue is that they did grant it to Meeker Co-op, and they did give certain assurances to them. Again, rightly or wrongly, they did do that, and Meeker Co-op proceeded under those circumstances.
Representative Solberg.
Just a follow-up. You were given $200,000 in sales tax. I'm trying to determine the cost of your building, of this new building that you put in, is that correct? And how much sales tax was involved in the new building as opposed to the ongoing sales tax for your wire and everything else later on. I would think maybe that would even go down to your trucks and so forth that you bring into the, how much sales tax is associated with the building itself.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the building cost, we put a total of about $5.6 million into the entire facility, and that was bringing water and sewer out, putting in a frontage road. It's everything that went into it. Pure building, I would guess maybe $3 million, $3.5 million. I do not have off the top of my head exactly what that sales tax savings or exemption was on the materials that went into that new building. We did get that. There's no question about that, and that's not what we're asking for. But you know, if you probably, and maybe somebody from Department of Revenue could tell me roughly what that might have been, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay, Madam Chair, that's fine.
All right, thank you. I would guess. And so, Mr. Michael doesn't have that number off the top of your head. All right. Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? All right. I'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mergen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members?
All right. Representative Broad, all smiles.
You want me to leave my picture?
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move House File 677 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Great.
Madam Chair and members, this bill essentially will align the treatment of biodiesel facilities to that which we already have in statute for ethanol facilities in regards to the Job Z time duration. Essentially, it'll allow the extension of Job Z benefits for an additional 3 years, which was done for ethanol facilities, I believe, in 2006.
Well, tonight might be your night, Representative Broad. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam.
Any questions from members? Any questions from the public who'd like to testify for or against? All right.
Thank
we'll
you.
Lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus text.
Thank
bill.
You very much.
Representative Howells? Representative Cohen, would you like to move House File 2329?
So moved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair. Almost promoted you there. Madam Chair, members. Last summer, five homes were destroyed in my district by fire, and it was vandalism. And our county assessor and county attorney don't believe that they can abate some of the property taxes because they believe it's, if it's committed by arson, that it, that they can't abate the taxes. So what this bill does, it's one sentence. If it's destroyed by arson or vandalism by someone under the, other than the owner, the county assessor could abate some of the property taxes.
Any questions for members? Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? All right, Representative Howells, House File 2329 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bet. Representative Marquardt, would you like to chair the...
Representative Volschlager, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. I'd like to move House File 1172.
Please proceed.
Well, with me here today to testify is Wayne Sather of the Department of Revenue. And this is a technical bill relating to state debt collection. It simplifies the current process via an electronic form. It changes and clarifies a few definitions. For example, referring agencies includes state agencies, courts, and the University of Minnesota. At this time, it does not include counties and cities. Looking forward, if these groups were to direct the Department of Revenue to collect for them, a definition like referring agency could certainly encompass these names. It will provide greater efficiencies. For example, the Department of Revenue will be moving from a two-tier fee schedule to a one-set fee at 17%. And the DOR has also developed a highly advanced collection process, and the number of debts collected is in the thousands. So they do expect some efficiencies. So with that, I'll ask my guest to add a few comments. Thanks.
All right. Mr. Sather or Sather?
I was about to say, my name is Wayne Sather, S-A-T-H-E-R. I was about to say, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman. And
please proceed.
The bill, as Representative Volschlager has pointed out, is primarily housekeeping and clarifying various things. And for example, as the representative has pointed out, that the original bill had both state agencies and referring agencies defined, and the real target of the bill, of the collection process, is referring agencies. So that's been changed to clarify it. There's some changes taking the Commissioner of Finance further out of the bill. The bill originally was the Commissioner, and the bill was the Commissioner of Finance. Several years ago, that was amended to the Commissioner of Revenue. So the references that are left, the Commissioner of Finance still receives some reporting. That's, I believe, on page 2. But otherwise, we've removed the Commissioner of Finance from the bill. There's a requirement in the bill that, I'm not going section by section, obviously, that the referring agencies are required to submit their debts electronically. Most of them already do, so if that's not a major change. The change about referring prior to the 120-day deadline is meant to clarify that. For some of the referring agencies thought they had to wait 120 days, when actually they can refer at any time, but after 120 days it becomes mandatory. And then the section about personal liability is in there because through various statutory recodifications since 1990, at which that time the personal liability sections were spread throughout tax chapters, well, they kind of got left behind at some point. So that section says that there's the possibility of personal liability for late payment penalties in those various taxes in Section 289A60. The lien transcription section, in 2002, the law was changed to require liens be filed at the Secretary of State's office for personal property, and this only affects debts, tax debts after 5 years. Before 5 years, you can collect without a lien at all, without a filed lien. But now the change is to allow liens to be transcribed from the Secretary of State to the counties. They already can go the other way, and that change is designed to enable, for example, the Secretary of State filings are usually out-of-state taxpayers or business taxpayers, and if real property is found after the original filing, that lien can now be transcribed to the county where the real property is located after the five-year limit. It does not affect the fact that the lien still will expire in 10 years. The transcribed lien will expire at the same time as the original. That's most of the changes. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Sather or Representative Olschlager from committee members? If not, is there anyone in the audience that would care to testify for or against House File 1172? Any closing comments, Representative?
But none that are repeatable.
With that,
Mr.
the chair
Sather,
yes.
Said that this would be more work for him, so he thought maybe he should testify against it. But
the chair will lay over House File 1172 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax
Thank
bill.
You.
And while the chair is coming back, if Representative Solberg, House File 19. Representative Solberg, we're going to do an overview on some of this tobacco taxes. And I don't know who's going to do that, Mr. Michael or Mr. Michael?
Do it from there.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Representative Lincheski requested that we, before the committee took up the cigarette and tobacco tax matters, that we quickly just sort of go through a very cursory overview. In your packets, you should find a buff or a beige-colored sheet like this that has some of the information on it. Just to remind you, Minnesota imposes a cigarette excise tax and, as of 2005, a health impact fee on cigarettes. These taxes and fees are imposed on a cents per pack basis. The regular tax is 48 cents. The health impact fee is an additional 75 cents. Cigarettes that are sold by manufacturers that are not part of the settlement agreement with the state are also subject to an additional fee that more or less offsets the fact that they don't have to pay settlement, ongoing settlement payments to the state, and this fee is equal to 35 cents. The sales tax as of the 2005 session is no longer collected based on price, but is set as a cents per pack amount. And you can see on the table there that originally it was set at 25.5 cents. That's indexed for inflation based on the price of cigarettes each year, and that's now, I think, for the current year, is 26.3 cents per pack. Tobacco products, by contrast with cigarettes, though, are subject to a percentage tax that's based on the wholesale price, and you'll shortly hear more about that. Just on the follow-up, the combined taxes raised for the state about $450 million, and that is sort of itemized or with more detail in the paragraph on the top of the second page. On the bottom of the second page is a map that shows the comparative rates in other states. Our bordering states are the most important, since that's where the greatest possibility for sort of cross-border sales occur. When the health impact fee was imposed and we went to $1.23 per cents per pack, we were the highest state in the neighboring, in the general area. Since then, South Dakota has raised its tax to $1.53, so they're now higher than Minnesota. The Iowa legislature just enacted, and the governor signed a week ago, an increase in the Iowa tax, so the Iowa tax is now higher. Lastly, the chair asked me to summarize proposals for cigarette tax increases in other states. There's a separate table that's on a white piece of paper that looks like this, that lists the governor's proposals that I was able to find that are recommending increases in their state cigarette taxes, and you can look down. There are quite a number of them. Listed on this sheet is the proposed increase. All of them are specific, except the Indiana governor made an unusual budget proposal, though it was an unspecified increase, and he said at least 25 cents. That's the one. The Iowa governor, as I indicated, that proposal has actually been enacted in law. In Indiana, the House of Representatives there rejected on a 52-44 vote the proposal there to increase their tax. If there are any questions, I can try to respond.
Representative Rucavina.
Madam Chair, the other Madam Chair is always worried about progressivity, so how regressive or progressive is the cigarette tax?
Madam Chair, Representative Rucavina, under the incidence study, the cigarette tax is, if not the most regressive, it's very close to being the most regressive. It's, you know, the difference is probably between it and the health impact fee and a couple of others, you know, might be close enough that it's statistically, I'm not sure that it's statistically significant, but it is very, one of the most regressive taxes that the state imposes.
And
of course, the sort of the rationale for it is to change behavior to deter people from smoking, or alternatively to compensate the government for the costs that they impose on the government. But it is very regrettable.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael,
Representative Rucavina, go ahead.
How much does the proposed tax, the new tier, what does that raise on the income tax?
So 400. Madam Chair, Representative Rucavina, I think the way to think about that is on an annual basis. The biennial numbers sort of confuse you because you get 2.5 years in the first biennium. I think in the first tax year, it's about $170 to $180 million in revenue.
In
additional revenue. An annual basis.
Calendar basis. Right. So we're only asking the wealthiest people to pay half of what the poorest people pay. That's a pretty good deal.
All right. Representative
Madam
Colbert?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move then the House File 1937, and then there's an amendment. I think it's A070347.
All right.
I would move that amendment to put the bill in the shape that we want it.
All right. Any questions to the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against?
That wouldn't pass good enough.
Right.
Madam Chair and members, this was brought to me by the cigarette wholesalers. And as I understand this, in the past, they are required to do some extraordinary services for the state and were given in the past also a rebate or a fee to be able to do that stamping of the cigarettes. And somehow or another, that was taken away from them. The adjustment in the amendment, I think, under the old law, the discount was 1.7%, but with the additional health impact fee and others for the cost associated with them, it's now reduced to 0.54%. And I have with me Thomas Bryant with the wholesalers group that will kind of explain this a little bit better than I can. In addition, you'll see in your packet, I think, a a picture of the stamping machines that they need to lease and for the state services.
All right, thank you. For the record, state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant. I'm with the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. Briefly, Madam Chair and members, the Department of Revenue has paid a cigarette stamping allowance to wholesalers since as far back as 1960. Up until 2003, when it was repealed as a part of a budget cost-saving measure. 48 states across the country pay a cigarette stamping allowance. We don't know of any other kind of taxpayer that incurs these kind of extraordinary tasks or costs to pay a tax on one single product. We surveyed our wholesalers and found that the wholesalers incur about $2.3 million per year in cost to stamp cigarettes. And that includes the rental fees for the machine that you see here. The Department of Revenue requires that we rent machines, so we have to rent one of these each year. The rent costs are between $7,000 and maybe $15,000 per year, depending on the size of the machine you have. It requires two employees to operate that machine. And then we also have to pay for the stamps that the state has us affixed to the individual packs of cigarettes. I have with me Ross Amundson of Amundson Tobacco from Bloomington. He brought a roll of stamps. This is what they look like. They're a heat-applied stamp. You really can't see them, but this is the sheets that we have to buy from the Revenue Department. So it costs about $200,000 a year to print these, which they run through this machine. And then we have to reimburse the state for those stamps that we put on the packs of cigarettes. So that's part of what we're asking as well, that the state not charge us for the price to print those stamps. A 0.54% stamping allowance equals about 0.8 cents per pack of cigarettes, or about 8 cents per carton of 10 packs of cigarettes. And the wholesalers right now pay $14.93 in taxes for each carton that they stamp. That includes your cigarette tax, your health impact fee, and the wholesalers are also required to pay the state sales tax. So we're only requesting 8 cents out of the $14.93 for a stamping allowance. A lot of these are small to medium-sized family businesses. In fact, one of the businesses in the state, a 100-year-old cigarette tobacco wholesaler, just closed their doors in January because they lost about 30% of their sales since the health impact fee went into effect. So they are struggling. They would appreciate your consideration of the reinstatement of the stamping allowance. Either I or Mr. Amundson would be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Any questions from members?
Madam Chair, just one closing thought. It seems like, you know, we always ask businesses to collect our sales tax, and we don't reimburse them for this, but this does seem to be an extraordinary type of activity that we're requesting of the wholesalers, particularly when it requires two people on that machine that they have to pay plus the stamps that they have to reimburse for. So I hope that the tax committee can give this some serious consideration.
Thank you, Representative. Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? All right, thank you. We'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Last but not least, Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney, would you like to move House File 2311?
Please, Madam Chair, my apologies. If I could move House File 2311 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the tax bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, House File 2311 would shift Minnesota from an ad valorem approach to the taxation of moist snuff to an excise tax model, moving us then from a price-based model to a fixed weight-based model for the taxation of these products. Why? It's simpler to administer, and it increases state revenues. With me tonight is Mr. Monty Williams, who is an expert in this field and can walk everyone through the materials in your packets and the concepts underneath it.
All right. For the record, please state your name.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Monty Williams. I'm a partner in a national consulting firm that deals in tobacco and alcohol issues throughout the country. I spent 30 years with the California State Board of Equalization. I was chief of excise taxes there and chief of criminal investigations for that state. I was responsible for over $3 billion in state revenue in California, and I have over 20 years of tobacco tax administration and enforcement experience. I'm here today representing United States Smokeless Tobacco, the makers of Copenhagen, Skoal, Red Seal, and Husky products. I'd like to talk to you today about two items that this bill addresses. One is the problem that we believe exists in the state of Minnesota with the application of tax to products, and we're talking about moist snuff here, the little round cans. And also an issue of the automatic tax escalator, which has been talked about significantly along this issue, that is the taxes go up every year. Excise taxes, by definition, are a consumption tax. They're a unit-based tax. Historically, they're applied to a product for some kind of social issue and based on the consumption of that product. All other excise taxes in the state of Minnesota are on a unit basis, with the exception of other tobacco products, of which moist snuff cans are included in that category. When the tax in Minnesota was adopted at an ad valorem basis, there was basically only one type of product sold, and that was a premium product. It all sold for one price and was in the same size can. So basically, when you adopted that tax, you were getting what an excise tax is, which is a per-unit tax. Since there was only one price that was sold for, one size, you got the same amount for each can sold. In 1989 in California, when we instituted the tax on other tobacco products for the first time, I looked at the issue there, and I actually established an ad valorem tax because when I looked at the marketplace and what was there, just as most of the other states did, it just made sense at that time. If I had it to do today, I wouldn't do it that way. And other states have found the same thing. For example, Pennsylvania governor has proposed the first tax on OTB this year in his budget process, and they're going to use a weight-based, not an ad valorem tax. 2 weeks ago, Iowa became the 10th state to convert to a weight-based system. There's reasons for these changes. Since 2001, the marketplace for this product has changed significantly. Rather than the one price and one type of product sold, you know, before 2001, basically there's now seven different major pricing points for this category. And so what you have now is the tax on this can is $2.11 in Minnesota. The tax on this can is 57 cents in Minnesota. So there's a huge disparity in the tax that's applied to the same products. Unlike cigarettes, which have Marlboros pay the same amount as a cheaper brand Broncos. They pay the same amount of excise tax, whereas these two cans pay different excise taxes. And that's not what an excise tax is supposed to do. It's based on a unit and a consumption. So the state's now receiving a lot less money for the can sold here than it did here. Because of this situation, the tax system has not kept up with the marketplace changes. So the state of Minnesota is now receiving 11% less on every can sold in this state than it did in 2004. And the reason for that is because these cheaper products now occupy over 39% of the market in Minnesota, which means it takes four cans of this to equal the tax on this. So that's impacted the revenues here in Minnesota significantly. We estimate that you're leaving approximately $9 million a year on the table due to this issue. Not only that, the retail selling price of these products can now be up to $2 difference simply based on the excise tax policy, which is not what an excise tax is supposed to do. The other thing that can happen is companies can change the amount of tax it's due on their products based on the selling price of the products. And let me give you some examples. For example, Marlboro in 1993 lowered its wholesale price 20%. Had no impact on the state of Minnesota's taxes because it's a per stick tax. It's a unit-based tax. This company lowered its wholesale price 45% last November. They also took a 45% decrease in the amount of tax that was owed on this, which thereby makes the tax revenues to the state go down and makes the product even cheaper in the marketplace. Your tax basis should not be based on what companies' price their products at. That's a sales tax, not an excise tax. Regardless of the types of products, they should all pay the same amount as a sales tax, as an excise tax is supposed to do, not a sales tax. Marlboros and Broncos pay the same amount of tax, but there's a $1.54 difference between Skoal and Longhorn, and that's not what an excise tax is supposed to do. I'd now like to talk about the automatic escalator issue. One of the things you'll hear is that for years an ad valorem tax is what they call a tax that keeps on giving. As the price goes up, your tax goes up. Well, the product with that now, problem with that today is that in 2004 it was a watershed point here where the amount of the cheaper products sold now is much larger than any price increases that have occurred. So what happens is your average tax per can goes down now. So this is no longer a tax that keeps on giving. It's going down every year instead of going up because the marketplace has changed and the tax policy did not change with the marketplace. And so by leaving it in an ad valorem system, you leave your state revenue subject to pricing policies. The other thing that's allowed is you can sell a 49-cent can at retail of Grizzly, which is the largest selling product made by Reynolds. The problem with this is you can only do this under an ad valorem system because it's based on a percentage of the price. Under a weight-based system or a per ounce, you can't sell a 49-cent can. This is less than a Snickers bar. You know, it shouldn't be made available at that based on the tax policy of the state. Your OTP revenues in Minnesota in 2004-05 actually went down for the first time. And that's due to this changing it down into the cheaper product purchasing categories. And it would have continued to go down without the increase that you did that year. But the number of cans being sold in these lower priced products is significantly increasing every year. This tax system is an escalator, but now it's a down escalator for the state. These issues are costing the state of Minnesota approximately $9 million a year. Opponents of moving to a weight-based can say many things about it, but the main factor is they do not want to give up their subsidy they have. Cheaper tobacco is being subsidized by the excise tax policy when you have an ad valorem tax system. They can make sales tax comparisons. You pay more on a Mercedes than you pay on a Ford. That's sales tax, not excise tax. They can talk about the little guy. Skoal and Longhorn will still have over a $3 difference at retail even if you move to the weight-based system that's being proposed. They can say that other states that switched have lost money. No state that has gone weight-based has lost money. That's simply not a true fact. State that has gone weight-based has lost money. That's simply not a true fact. The bottom line is the state subsidizing cheap tobacco. Minnesota is losing a substantial amount of revenue each year. It's an unfair system which no longer meets the definition of a good excise tax. It's not sound excise tax policy, and the playing field needs to be leveled as it was prior to 2001. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Any questions for members? Representative Yarrow?
Maybe you could show us how to raise another $900 to $1 billion another way.
Madam Chair, Representative, let me give that some salt and thought, and I'll get back to you. Okay.
We do have a number of other testifiers. So, any other questions from members? Anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against? Oh, we'll have to add a chair or... Or take turns or...
Ooh, that could be more challenging.
You know, whatever gentlemen do, please. Please right proceed ahead. As gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. May it please the committee.
For the record, state your name.
Yes, thank you. My name is Bob Maples, and I appear today on behalf of Swisher International Incorporated, a price value manufacturer of smokeless tobacco products. Swisher is opposed to the proposed conversion from the current ad valorem to a weight-based tax because primarily it is a tax increase on consumers of adult price value products, and because it is special interest legislation, which places a tax cap on the products of the sole proponent of this legislation, intended to increase their market share and reduce competition. By way of introduction, I've had a long history like Mr. Williams in the tobacco business. I'm currently a senior advisor in government relations for law firm Dickstein Shapiro, LLP, a retained consultant to Swisher International. I've been associated with the tobacco industry for more than two decades. I worked for the Smokeless Tobacco Council, an industry trade association in Washington, for 10 years, from 93 to 2003. I was its president from 98 to 2003. And from 1993 to 96, I had the pleasure of working closely with the proponent's company, UST, as it was known then, when it was a member of the council. The proposal is a tax increase on adult consumers, and it does place a cap on these tax on premium products. And all too often, I think, when we've had these discussions across the United States, we forget sometimes it's the adult consumer who will pay the tax. These hardworking tax-paying citizens, your constituents, are only attempting to get the best products for the lowest price. You have heard arguments that the tax system is broken, but and that the price-value products are receiving a subsidy, I just heard. But the truth is the system is working just fine as it is. It's actually given consumers a choice in the marketplace and adjust to market changes to actually increase the tax on smokeless tobacco products as inflation and other market factors increase the product's value. A conversion to a unit or a weight-based tax would break the progressive nature of the current ad valorem tax and provide a cap on future tax levels. A weight-based tax system requires separate legislation to provide an increase in the tax on moist snuff tobacco products. Quite frankly, the problem is not the tax. The problem is the price the proponents choose to charge for their products. The price gap that is alleged to have resulted occurred over time and grew primarily from a lack of managerial vision to see the growing gap and to effectively manage the situation. The proponents have never really faced competition in the marketplace until about 1994 with the introduction of Timberwolf by a competitor. Over recent time, other products have entered the category with lower price points than dominant premium brands, and the literal monopoly in the category ended. This legislation is intended to limit that competition, raise taxes on constituents, and put a tax cap on their products. Price value manufacturers set their prices based on the marketplace and their ability to compete in a category. Tax policy plays no role in that decision. All of us in this room, when we're faced with rising prices, look for ways to save money and cut costs. I was struck recently when an expert for proponents was on a Mississippi talk show when a caller called in and made the following point. Some of those premium products just cost too much. That statement pretty much sums it up. Proponents are going to lobby, and they're going to give you fancy charts, they're going to create numbers, they're going to talk about numbers on the table, off the table. At the end of the day, the issue is competition in the marketplace, not changing the rules to give one dominant company a competitive advantage. The current tax rate is agnostic. It chooses neither winners nor losers. Manufacturers make independent business decisions based on all economic factors, decide to enter and compete in the marketplace based on those factors. It's not the tax, it's the economy. Madam Chair, thank you. Members, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to provide opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Maples. Any questions from members?
Okay, Madam Chair.
Sure. For the record?
For the record, my name is Stan Arnold, and I am currently employed at a law firm in Concord, New Hampshire. Rath Young and Pignatelli, one of the clients of the law firm, is Reynolds American and Conwood, which is a wholly owned subsidiary and manufactures moist snuff. As legislators, you recognize probably that there's a truism that's out there. If somebody comes in and asks you to raise their taxes, then the tax doesn't fall on them. And that's exactly what the case is here. And the reason I can say that with some authority is that I've been involved in state and local taxes for about 30 years. I started as a preparer. I was an auditor for the New Hampshire Department of Revenue on business taxes. I was assistant director of the audit division, and I spent 14 years as commissioner of revenue under four different governors. I've also, since I've left state government, I have been working as a senior tax policy advisor, written articles on tax issues. I have appeared in a number of states in front of tax commissions talking about tax policy. So I do have a little bit of experience in there. I think it's important as we go through this, as for an example, that let me just point out one of the red herrings that are going to be added. You've seen a few of them already. That 49-cent can, that the manufacturer is special. The manufacturers are required to pay all of the tax for that. So it isn't that the tax gets based on the 49 cents. It gets based on what the normal rate would be. It's a leader article. I think the question that needs to be asked is, who does this help in Minnesota? I mean, why would you be asked to make this type of a change, and who in Minnesota? Well, we know that the people who buy the high end, they're going to see no difference in the amount of tax that they pay. There won't be any change there. But you will see an effective tax rate of close to 200% based on the price of the lowest product, and this is going to be on those individuals, those citizens in Minnesota who are the most price conscious. And it will definitely impose a big burden on them. And why would we be doing this? Is because if the U.S. entrepreneurial system is working, that true competition leads to better products and lower prices. Why would a state now wish to artificially raise the prices of the products that have shown that they can compete? And the test really in this is what you would do if you remove the tax completely, an excise tax. It would leave all of the competitors in the relatively same position they are today. But, you know, they really don't want that. USD doesn't want to do away with the complete excise tax. They want the tax to fall on the competitors because it will help their competitive position. It only helps the shareholders in Connecticut. Investors don't look at a tax paid. They look at the ROI. They're looking at the return on investment when they invest in these particular companies. You change the tax system, you freeze the tax expense if you put it on a weight base. Any price increase then that occurs after that now goes directly to profit. You have the power to tax this any way you wish to. Every state has that. But to do it for the correct reason. Don't impose a tax rate on the Minnesota citizens of moderate means just to help the shareholders in Connecticut. There are going to be a lot of theories that are being offered to justify the need, but USD still remains the dominant in this industry and wants your help to maintain its competitive position. Mr. Williams says that the law was first enacted as ad valorem, and it was no problem because prices were the same. The competition arrived, and now it becomes a problem. That's competition. That's the system we work in. Several years ago, one of the articles that have been quoted in other states that I've been in on the Tax Foundation took the position that all excise taxes are anti-competitive, and they were correct. They are by their very nature. So why do we want to put in a good system, take a good system, and put in the 19th century system? Excise taxes were put in many, many years ago. They were one of the prime ways that the federal government raised its revenue. They were done away with because they're a bad system of taxation. For example, liquor is already offered as being a place where excise taxes have to be, and somehow that this needs to be the same. But in, like, for an example, in New Hampshire, the way that they did it, to take away the bad part of the excise taxes, they run state stores, and they compete on a competitive basis in the regular market as far as that the profit then becomes what the state gets. So again, this is all about competition. Don't allow your state to be used as a competitive weapon. It doesn't help Minnesotans. It does hurt some of the Minnesotans in there, and in the long run it will help you, it will hurt your revenue stream, because currently you have two drivers. You have both the volume increases and the price increases. If you were to pass this bill, you're cutting one of those increases off, and all you're going to get any increases would be from volume. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Maples or Mr. Arnold, how does the federal government treat these products?
federal government has a weight-based tax on smokeless tobacco. It's on the raw leaf of the tobacco before any the tax is assessed, before any improvements or modifications are made to the product. So it is a weight-based tax, but it's based on the amount of tobacco you actually purchase.
And, Madam Chair, and Mr. Arnold, you had said about the 49-cent can. I'm looking at one of the charts we've got here, and I can't remember which of the product it was, so depending on what the wholesale price and what the tax rate is, that by my math, some of these are being sold at anywhere from an 8 to a 20-cent cost to the manufacturer. If it costs, if the wholesale price or if the tax is 81 to 57 or 91 to 64, they're charging 49 cents, so you're taking at least a 50 to 75% hit when you sell each one of these products?
Mr. Arnold, through the chair.
The 49-cent can is a manufacturer's lead item on a sale item, like they do with the cigarettes. They're required to pay whatever the normal manufacturer's price would be. Those are not normally sold at 49 cents. And they're taking a hit because they are for a limited time sale type of an item that are given to directly to dealers to encourage them to use those brands.
I'm sure you're fine. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Arnold, so then under the current system, the conversation about the subsidy coming up, if you're selling it that low and then you're not paying the same tax as one of these other products, that, I mean, it would be a pretty substantial subsidy, I guess, if you're looking at the price and the amount of tax paid. I'd say that's anywhere from a $2 to $3 subsidy that the state of Minnesota or whatever state is giving to those folks that are selling a 49-cent tin.
Mr. Arnold?
Let me try to clarify. You go back to what manufacturers choose to price the product at, right? They set the price. Mm-hmm. According to the state of Maryland, I have a fiscal note that I can get to you from the state. Think of this. UST sells Skoal for $3.01 a can right now. They make $2.40 off every can that they sell. Everybody would like to be able to do that, but you can't do that and you can't compete that way. So it's what a manufacturer chooses to make at the out end is what you set the price for. Well, no subsidy. You're just not making as much money per can.
All right. Through the chair here, I know it's
sorry.
It's interesting.
Yes. Thanks.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had a long discussion in the last couple of years about a fee and a tax. So I guess the subsidy and the the manufacturer's sale price, I guess, is a yet another tail twister we'll have for a while. But one other last question for either Mr. Maples or Mr. Arnold. As you both said, you represent Reynolds. Why not the same system then for cigarettes?
This, Madam Chair.
Sure. Either Mr. Maples or Mr. Arnold. Right. Thanks.
Representative Sella, I can't speak from a cigarette standpoint, but I think that is a completely different system that has been put into place, and there's not a lot of price difference between the products. From the standpoint of looking at it from a tax policy standpoint, when the states decided to put in the system, they looked at it in today's viewpoint from the 1980s. The cigarette taxes are leftover legacy taxes, as well as the tax on beer and liquor and on gasoline, for example. And that's not part of this bill here, and it would be something you'd have to look at. What would be administrative cost of trying to change a system of that magnitude into a different type of system? This is a case where the states purposely adopted, as Mr. Wilson said, and I was in New Hampshire, I was the commissioner in New Hampshire when we adopted taxing other tobacco products, and we elected to do it by using a modern system of taxation. We compete in a capitalistic society. That's unfortunately may be the case if you wanted to take it that way, but it's a very good system from the standpoint it requires people to compete. And prior to the 1980s, UST was a monopoly. It was a granted monopoly by the federal government as a result of antitrust action back in 1911. And they had no competitors until in the 80s. And what they started to have was competitors came in and they competed the way we want business to compete. They competed, they came up with new products, and they came up with lower prices. People that benefit from that, I don't think that that's wrong. Why would we now turn around and say, oh, you shouldn't have been competing that way in our society. We're going to tax you more heavily to make it harder for you to compete. And I believe if you would look at the fiscal note, and I would suggest, and I know the department here, and every department has the fiscal note they have to do based on the legislative guidelines, but to take a look at the system as to what the revenue would be if you continued the current system in comparison to changing to this, I think that you would show that you would decrease. I don't think you would show a net increase. You're not leaving money on the table. It's broadening the whole market in this particular case is expanding. And you're gaining as a state, and so does the rest of the states gain in that particular case. This is a vibrant market.
Right. Thank you. Representative Maureen. Lanning. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I've been called worse.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, as all of you know, Minnesota has established a practice of imposing what has been called a health impact fee. Many people call it a tax on other tobacco products. And I guess I'm wondering, and in the case of both parties here, what your view, what your perspective, what your position is on the imposition of any kind of health impact fee on this tobacco product.
I mean, I don't take a position on that. I know it is unique here. I saw it when I came into to Minnesota for the first time. I believe you're the only state that does that. I hadn't seen that before. But I believe your courts have already ruled on whether the fee is allowed to be on. And so, I mean, from a policy standpoint, as I said before, the legislature has the authority. I've worked with a number of legislators. I know it's a difficult job, and you have to pay the bills ultimately, what you have to do. But what I'm saying is you can pay the bills just as well under the current system you have. You don't need to change the whole system in order to be able to pay the bills.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Sure.
I'd like both parties to address the issue.
Mr. here. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane. I'm not quite sure I understood your question. You want to know what our opinion is of having a health impact fee on the marketplace, or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, currently this product does not have a health impact fee, tax, whatever you want to call it, imposed on. And I guess I'm wondering what your position is relative to the state imposing health impact fee on your product, as we do other tobacco products.
Madam
All right,
Chairman,
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chairman, Representative Lanning, the health impact fee does apply to these products. It was approximately a 35% tax rate in Minnesota, and then when the health impact fee, it doubled that to 70%. So currently today, that health impact fee does apply to these products.
So, Madam Chair, that information isn't included on this chart, though, is it?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it is. That's current information based on the current tax rate of approximately 70% ad valorem taxes in the state of Minnesota. So the one bar is the wholesale price, and the blue bar, I believe it in, is the tax at a 70% rate, which is the original tax plus the health impact fee.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, could you help sort this out? I'm having trouble trying to sort out the health impact fee from this information we've been receiving here.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the health impact fee does apply to these products, and essentially the way it applies is it doubles the excise. Like what the excise tax is 35%, then the health impact fee is 35%, so the combination is 70%. Looking at this graph that the proponents have passed out, the way their bill is written, the bill provides for an 81-cent per ounce excise tax rate, and that will be, by existing statute, doubled, and will convert the health impact fee to a weight-based health impact fee too. I think there may be a mistake in their graph. I know if you look, for example, at, I assume you're looking at this page with the bars on it.
Yes.
And it shows on the left, for example, I'm not sure whether this is if it's referring to an ounce, I guess I'm not exactly clear how they prepared this, but an ounce of the product under their bill would pay is $1.82 per ounce. They're showing here 81 cents. I'm not clear. They could better speak to that, but their bill will convert both the tax and the health impact fee to a weight-based system, and so it would be $1.82 per ounce or proportionate part thereof, whereas now it's a 70% tax fee combination. It may have confused you more than I helped.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you. The increased revenue that's anticipated through this bill, would the proportion of that going to the health impact fee change, or are they proportionately kept the same, both the existing tax as well as the impact fee?
Representative, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, yes. Essentially, the way it would work is half of the revenue would flow just as it does now, and it won't make any difference. The Department of Revenue has not yet prepared a revenue estimate, to my knowledge of this. So if it raises, let's say the proponents are correct, then it's estimated to raise $9 million. That half of that money would go into the general fund and half would go into the health impact fee fund or whatever I can't remember the name of the fund anymore. But, of course, ultimately that flows back into the general fund if the Department of Human Services can certify there are enough costs. So, but, yes, the revenues would flow as they do now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I clarify
yes.
the chart just so
Mr. Williams.
Thank you. On the chart you're looking at, the way it was prepared, just for an issue of clarification, is the red bar is the wholesale price, and the blue bar is the tax on that wholesale price at a 70% rate, if that helps you understand that chart better. Thank you.
We are going to try to adjourn at 7:30, not to pressure anyone. Any questions from members? Any other questions? All right. Any other testifiers? For the record, state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Corrine Ertz. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. I'm here today to, I have a letter to pass out as well. I'm here today to express our opposition to House File 2311 as it's currently written. I'd like to distribute a letter to you written by the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, the American Heart Association, Clearway, Minnesota, the Association of Non-Smokers, and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, opposing this legislation. As organizations dedicated to improving the health of Minnesotans by preventing disease, reducing tobacco use, we believe that this bill will have significant unintended consequences for public health. Specifically, in the long run, this bill will make smokeless tobacco products cheaper and more attractive and accessible to youth. Not surprising, this legislation's strongest supporter is UST, the major manufacturer of smokeless tobacco products subject to 2311, including those premium brands that are most attractive to kids. While House File 2311 would, in the short run, increase taxes on some lower-priced smokeless products and temporarily increase state revenues, over time, it would reduce the taxes on those smokeless products most popular with kids and increase youth use rates. The proposed switch to a weight-based tax on moist snuff smokeless tobacco products would cause two major problems. First, a fixed amount weight-based tax fails to keep up with inflation or with smokeless tobacco product prices increases over time. And that means less money for the state, cheaper smokeless tobacco products, and higher use rates, especially amongst kids. Second, the next generation of moist snuff products, such as UST's Skoal Dry, weigh much less than traditional moist snuff products. A percentage of price system would tax them fairly, but they would largely be avoid to taxation. A percentage of price system would tax them fairly, but they would largely avoid taxation under the weight-based system that House File 2311 would establish. Again, that means state revenue losses, lower prices, and higher use rates as these new low-weight moist snuff products take over a larger and larger share of the smokeless market. At the same time, House File 2311 has a laudable goal of trying to address the fact that under the existing price per pack tax, very low-cost moist snuff smokeless products pay only a relatively small tax per can or per package. But that issue could be much more effectively addressed without any of the problems causing by switching to a weight-based tax system by simply adding a minimum tax to our existing system for taxing moist snuff smokeless tobacco products. Unlike the weight-based switch of House File 2311, establishing a minimum tax in our existing tax structure would not only raise revenues in the short term, but would protect the future state revenues and would not create any risk of raising smokeless tobacco use rates amongst kids. For these reasons, I urge you to oppose this legislation, keep the ad valorem tax for all tobacco products other than cigarettes. If we're going to tinker with our system of taxation, let's do it in a way that protects state tobacco tax revenues, both in the short term and the long run, and most importantly, helps reduce, not increase, tobacco use amongst kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ertz. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Ertz. I'm having a hard time understanding, as someone who received several of your brochures as a youth from my parents when I was a smokeless tobacco user, you probably helped to keep me from continuing my habit, but I'm trying to figure out if at 49 cents a tin, that's, I mean, for a buck you can get a week's supply or maybe even a little bit more, how if we're going to increase the price, as some of the advocates and proponents have, or opponents and proponents have said, how do you figure that we're going to have more kids starting to chew if it's going to be at a higher price? I'm just not getting the math, which is understandable because I'm not a math expert, but I'm just trying to figure the logic here of if it's going to cost more, kids are going to chew more.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative, I think what we're trying to say is that the weight-based system that is being proposed in this legislation is one that's not going to change over time as the price of tobacco increases, and the wholesale price of tobacco increases. And although there may be some short-term adjustments that may happen as a result of this legislation, it handicaps the overall effect of the tobacco tax over time, which is to prevent youth, in this, or one of our objectives in the tobacco tax increases is to prevent youth initiation in the long run. So although, again, this tax or this proposal in the short run may have some, you know, adjustments in terms of the cost of tobacco products, in the long run we feel as though that it handicaps the state more in terms of and the tobacco tax as a youth initiation tool more.
Madam Chair, just, you know, I did. I grew up, if Rickabina was here, he'd say, well, he grew up on a farm, so it's, you know, he doesn't have his fingers and toes out, he might not be able to count. Yeah. But if we do nothing and we leave the ad valorem in place, some of these 49 cent products, by one of the charts that we have here, we actually are seeing increase in that amount of smokeless tobacco in the marketplace, which, again, doing the math, if there's more of it out there, there's more opportunity for kids to get a hold of it. Again, and this is using your logic, I'm not saying for or against, but under that logic, there's going to be more of it out there. So is it that you're advocating just another tax, and at 70%, I think we're pretty high up there. I guess we got 30 left to go, if that's what you're advocating, but I'm just not, still not quite getting it. So are you saying then to just do away with this version and the Representative Dabney's bill and just go to a flat new tax on top of it, or a smokeless fee or an MST fee or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative, what we're saying is that if we oppose this legislation for the reasons that I outlined, that we feel as though in the long run that the tobacco tax will not increase as price increase with under a weight-based system. And if you feel as though that it's important to undercut or try and get into the competitive market that has been outlined before me, if you feel as though the lower price products are that extreme of a problem, then set a minimum tax standard for those products, or a minimum tax for those products, and not change your tax system from a percentage-based system to a weight-based system.
Well, Madam Chair, and I think that's what we're doing, but I'll defer to other members. I know we're past our 7:30 deadline, so thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you, Representative. Oops. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize to the members that I came in very late. I was in another meeting. As you all know, things are going on all at the same time. But just as I understand it, Representative Zeller's part of their problem is that they're expecting the weights to actually decrease with the change in the product, which would drop the tax. That's one of the issues. And the other is that it doesn't increase over time because it's not a percentage of the price. So they're looking more toward the long term, that they don't think that this is going to, that the prices won't continue to rise, the tax won't continue to rise. I think that's the issue, right? Mm-hmm. So I hope that is helpful.
Representative Sellers.
Yeah, that's fine, Madam Chair. I would say, obviously, they haven't been in Minnesota long then, because if anybody who's been to tax committee, and after what happened with the fee versus impact fight and the lawsuit, I think I'd be willing to bet my house that at some point in the next 10 or 20 years, the price on tobacco products is going to be raised. I'd be willing, more than willing to bet that.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I address that issue to Representative? The average tax per can in the state of Minnesota is not increasing anymore due to price increases. It's actually going down per year now because of the cheaper products being sold that are paying such a much less tax burden than other products being sold. So that automatic price increase that was being addressed here is no longer applicable in the state of Minnesota. That's actually changed as of the beginning of 2005. So that part of it. And as far as the lower weight products, there currently are some slightly less than an ounce pouch products in the marketplace. But as far as changing to extremely lower weight products to game the tax system, there really isn't anything out there that does that at this point. And there's a problem that exists right now, and this weight-based would address that. And if there is a problem in the future with something else, it can always be addressed at that time. Thank you.
Just Representative Liebling, we did have about a 25-minute discussion on the differences in the products. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to testify for or against? All right. Well, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I would like someone to move the minutes for Mr. Representative Zellers. Announcements, the Friday meeting is canceled.
No. But,
sorry. You know, I'm so excited that we've almost made the 7:30 deadline. We do have to vote on the minutes, so all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All those opposed? All right. Meeting adjourned. Motion carried.
meeting.